It's time for Twit, a great big show for you because we've got great big personalities. Dwight Silverman makes his return from the Houston Chronicle, the wonderful Serenity Caldwell from iMore.com, and the witty Ian Thompson. We're going to talk about Bitcoin, why robots are being banned on San Francisco's streets, have AI, artificial intelligence, has turned a big corner, Waz's reaction to the iPhone 10, and the new emojis. They're on their way. It's all coming up next on Twit.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 644, recorded Sunday, December 10th, 2017. This is fine. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Fracture. Fracture is a photo decor company that prints your photos directly onto glass and then delivers them to your door ready to display right out of the box. Visit fracture.me and use the code TWIT15 at checkout to get 15% off your first order. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com/twit to save 20% off your order. And by Capterra. Find software solutions for your business needs. Capterra is a free website with over 500 categories of business software and thousands of ratings and reviews from software users just like you. Visit capterra.com/twit today. And by Texture. Access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Try it free for 14 days at texture.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. We're here, gathered together once again on a Sunday. It's kind of tech church, in a way, with Ian Thompson from theregister.co.uk. You're a tech believer, I believe.
I believe in what works, yes.
For a while, Ziff Davis's motto was believe in technology. And I thought that was so hokey that I would, at the end of the screensavers, I would say things like believe in technology, but, you know, back up your hard drive.
You see, I preferred the mission statement from New Scientist, which is science is interesting. If you don't agree with that, F off.
Is that really?
Darkness
really dies in science.
That's Serenity Caldwell. Hey, I haven't seen you in an age. It's so nice to see you again.
I know.
Not since you got married. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And
thank you. It's nice to be back.
You're in Montreal playing a roller derby on the Canadian national team.
Yes.
That's great.
I'm in Rhode Island now, but we'll be back there in a few short weeks.
Oh, I can't tell. Rhode Island, Montreal, it's all snowy now. You got your first
snow. It's true. We've got I'm very glad that I'm inside right now. I considered hanging up my lights, but that was a tech step too far. I'd rather talk about tech than do it right now in the cold.
We got a guy here who actually does this for a living. He is visiting our studio today. And his company decorate malls for the holidays, and they did in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. You'll shoot your eye out. The Christmas story. They did a Santa's. You know
you
how
have
they
dark Christmas stories over here. That's you know, sound like fun.
That's how I remember it. You know the Red
Santa
Rider.
Santa mugged kids for presents and shot their
eye out. No. He does it. They did a Christmas story mall. And they even have, you know, one of the main features of that movie is the leg lamp, the major award, the Fragile major award. Look, there's a slide. There's Santa. It's the whole house from the movie. Anyway, night. So if you want some help, Serenity, I'm just saying, I got some friends.
You got a guy.
I can hook you up. Also with us, my goodness, he's going to make a big deal about it. Serenity not being here for a long time, but this is a guy who actually recused himself for a while. He said, I'm not doing technology anymore. Dwight Silverman is back. We're so glad to have you back.
I'm back. I couldn't stay away. I tried to get out, and they pulled me back.
The grill master from Houston Chronicle's Tech Burger section. So what happened? You decided you didn't want to write about tech anymore, or
they wanted me to do to manage our subscriber website, and so I did that for a year and a half, and we decided that Well, actually, there was some research that New York had done that said, surprise, people in Houston want more technology coverage.
And so
they came to me and said, you want to do a tech site again? And I said, yes. And because I really didn't miss it.
So what's the story with tech? I mean, I love it because it's very memorable and you've got a giant digital hamburger. HoustonChronicle.com/techburger.
Our digital hamburger. That's great. So when we were coming up with names, you know, I threw in a bunch of names that I thought sounded techie, like I wanted to call it Scan or something like that.
Yeah.
And just as kind of as a joke, I had all these serious sounding tech names and I threw in Techburger. And as we were going through kind of eliminating them, my boss kept saying, I really like Techburger.
I really like Techburger.
And so we wound up doing it. And what's nice about it is, first of all, everybody remembers it.
It's very
People
memorable.
Either think it's stupid or they start giggling when they hear it. Right. And it gives us a chance to do some really good puns. So the daily link post, which I've resurrected and kind of beefed up a bit, is called Here's the Beef. We have the AP feed, which keeps live tech news flowing onto the site, is called Extra Cheese. The little short items at the top of the page is called Sliders.
As long as you don't end up in a pickle, then you're fine.
That's right. I'm trying to figure out what to call the condiments section, what to put in condiments, or fries.
The only thing I don't like about this is making me hungry.
Yes. So we are. It's been a lot of fun. I've been doing a lot more writing, and also I'm able to play with. You know, I'm able to use all of our wire services, so I can use Washington Post and Bloomberg and Business Insider, so I can keep the site pretty much up to date. And it's more issues oriented as opposed to gadget oriented, which is kind of what I was doing before. And so far, the reception has been really good, and we're just going to keep plugging away.
You know, that's actually an interesting distinction, because I think when a lot of our shows are gadget-oriented and product-oriented, buying-oriented, and help and how-to-oriented. Yeah. But I've always been much more interested in the issues of technology. And so this show has really always been more of an issue show. Right. Do you find readers want issues?
I think in 2017, people are much more attuned to things like security and the effect that technology and social media is having on society. I think that people are much more interested in that, I think, than they were, say, 2 or 3 years ago, and because they're acutely aware of what can happen. And so I would much rather be doing that. I think it serves our purpose better, and it serves kind of what journalism needs to be doing right now. So I'm excited to be a part of it.
A lot of big stories this week. Bitcoin hit $20,000 briefly and then went back down, causing a lot of people, including me, to go, where is that Bitcoin wallet I had lying around?
The amount of people who've been doing that over the last couple of months is just like, I know I've got some somewhere.
I have, and I'm embarrassed to admit it, 7.85 Bitcoin, which at the going rate is almost $100,000, and I can't unlock the wallet because I forgot the password. But it's sitting right on my desktop.
Oh, no.
I know. I'm not alone. This is actually, I think it was estimated about a third of all Bitcoin are held somewhere by somebody who doesn't seem to have any ability to get at it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a huge tranche of the original Bitcoin which have never been used.
Well, mostly those are Satoshis, right?
Yeah, but then now the quest is on for who is Satoshi, and I thought I'd track down who it was a couple
you
of
did?
Weeks ago.
And, you well, join a, by the way, a rich panoply of tech journalists, all of whom.
Oh yeah, we've all claimed got, Elon Musk him. Got fingered for being Satori earlier this week, and it was like, yeah, forget it, that's not going to happen.
So, who do you think Satoshi Nakamoto?
Well, I don't want to say his name because basically, this guy has come up in the past. His family have been on the brunt of a bunch of hacking attacks, but it looked good. So, I spoke to some people who knew him. He's unfortunately passed on now. And
that makes sense because he has billions.
Yeah.
And so he has not touched it.
This is someone who I've known and trusted for over a decade. And he was like, look, you know, I've worked with this guy. I know, you know, we've talked about it. He's denied it to my face. And the evidence just doesn't stack up. So everyone's looking for this guy. And it's probably, I think deep down, it's probably two or three people. And there's a whole bunch of Bitcoin that are just missing somewhere. And
even in the original paper, they use the pronoun we.
Yeah. I think it's definitely a group.
It sounds to me like it was a group. They weren't even trying to hide it, but they just used a single pseudonym to represent themselves.
Yeah.
But they, as with any pyramid scheme, and you could make a case that Bitcoin is just another pyramid scheme.
Huge case for that.
As with any pyramid scheme, the person who starts it is the one who makes all the money, and they own billions of dollars in Bitcoin. But have not. We would know the minute they moved it. We would know because people know which bitcoins are Satoshis, and they seem to have no inkling. And I would think now, if ever,
now would be the time to get on. And
unless I'm completely wrong, I mean, there are a lot of people. Well, like the Winklevoss twins. Look at these guys. So they are the famous Harvard crew twins. Mm-hmm. You saw them in the Facebook movie The Social Network, and I don't know how accurate that movie was, but I think there was some accuracy to the idea that they had, as Harvard seniors, commissioned a Harvard freshman named Mark Zuckerberg to write some software for them for a social network they had in mind. Mark ghosted on him, disappeared, ended up, the next time they saw him, releasing something called the Facebook, and the rest is history. They sued him, and now, we never knew what the settlement was, but this week I saw a story saying they parlayed the $11 million settlement, which would make sense, not huge, but something, into Bitcoin billions. They went all in on Bitcoin, and they're now, and they're still just as handsome, Bitcoin, and they still match perfectly. Matching bookends, Bitcoin.
Oh, my dear.
Billionaires. The Winklevi.
The Winklevi, as we call it.
I mean, they insist they haven't sold any Bitcoin yet, and they were talking about getting exchange going. But, you know, we saw with exchanges this week earlier on that, you know, transmission times are going way down. Exchange costs
up, really. They're getting slower.
Well, yeah, they're getting slower.
Yeah, it will take as much as 20 hours or something to do a transaction.
And you got Steam refusing to take Bitcoin this week because the transaction
costs. Because it's too volatile.
Yeah.
And it's too volatile.
And even some drug dealers on the darknet complaining that, you know, they were having to get out. I know, my heart bleeds for them, right?
Man, man, you can't pay me in Bitcoin anymore, man. It's too volatile.
And then Mondeo is now, you know, every...
Monero. That's the one that people are using.
Coinhive, yeah.
And others are using to take over your browser when you visit websites. You actually start running a mining.
Yeah, you contribute your spare CPU cycles to them. And to be fair, CoinHive has said, we're not developing that software anymore. We're now developing a new bit of software which does the same, but insists that you get user consent before you do it.
The problem with CoinHive, and by the way, I'm glad to say I am blocked from CoinHive by my uBlock origin, which is as it should be. The problem with CoinHive, its software had been weaponized. This is a security issue. And instead of, I think you could make the case, while you're reading a site, it uses a few spare CPU cycles.
Yeah.
If a coin drops out, well, then that's our monetization strategy. Yeah, I agree. You need to tell people you're doing that. But I think that's kind of no harm, no foul. But they had been modified to continue to run after you closed your browser. Just sit on your system and run all the time in the background. And that is not okay.
No.
No, that's disgusting behavior, quite
honestly. It's also getting on mobiles, and that burns through battery power like nothing else. If you feel your mobile getting hot, it might be worth checking out on that one.
Well, and you should probably be running a blocker like uBlock Origin on those kinds of
A lot of the antivirus and a lot of the ad blocking people are now getting wise to this, thank goodness.
Yeah, because it is a virus. Mm. Although, am I wrong? What do you think, Serenity? I mean, the idea that iMore, for instance, I mean, the way you, that's an expensive site. You got to make money. The only way you make money is with banner ads. I guess it's the primary way. I can't say it's the only way, but you make money on banner ads. What would it take for somebody like Mobile Nations to say, well, maybe we should just do this, babe? Say, hey, would you mind if we used, while you're sitting on the site, just did a little JavaScript to mine Bitcoin? Would people just say, no, that's not going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the asking is the first step, right? Is saying, hey, we are actually going to do this. So is it cool with you guys if we use your CPU cycles? But honestly, to me, it comes back to the problem that we've had with intrusive banner ads from the very beginning, which is that no one wants to visit a site that's slow.
Right.
And if I'm going to be using spare CPU cycles of yours to mine Bitcoins, I am inherently going to make your web experience slow. And you're either going to use something like AMP, or you're going to use Reading List, or one of the numerous other ways that you can use to read our content without running into that, because again, you want the faster experience. So I really can't see any way in which this would be a profitable solution for people. it would just end up, like, even if everybody was totally fine with the prospect of, oh yeah, you can use my computer to mine Bitcoins, I still feel like they're not going to be okay with it from a slowness standpoint.
Yeah,
who
but
voluntarily
okay, but,
checks that box?
But here I am on Bloomberg site, and CNET does this, a lot of sites do it, and live television, live video starts loading, probably using more bandwidth, and I'm certainly using more bandwidth, and probably
certainly
using more CPU cycles
yeah.
than a little Bitcoin miner. That's really annoying. We kind of accept that. I would like to turn it off, but my ad blocker won't. I think this is a problem. I mean, we need to everybody acknowledges we need to monetize these free internet services. They're really great. There needs to be a way to monetize.
Absolutely.
I feel like if there were some, the problem is you're right. Everybody would just say no, you can't. No. That's why they don't tell you, because you'd say no.
Unless there was some incentive to come back to you, if it was shared,
we'll split it.
Bitcoin mining,
yeah,
where you might get something, that might be worth it. But just the whole idea of asking somebody, hey, can I use your computer to make some money for me? That's just too creepy. And I think most people, even if they were incentivized to say it, we'll give you a little bit, would ultimately people would just say no.
Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, we saw with SETI at home that people are actually willing to lend out their spare CPU cycles.
Yeah, but that's searching
but
for
that's alien life.
That's cool.
Yeah, well, the principle is a little different.
There's a benefit to that.
Yeah. What's the benefit? I don't think we should find aliens. If they're out there, leave them alone. Everybody says, oh, we're all worried about artificial intelligence. Screw that. What about the aliens?
Yeah, Ian Banks, the science fiction author, calls this the outside context problem. Whereby, you're getting your civilization around, and then all of a sudden these people turn up with sticks that have gunpowder in them and ships that can go against the wind. And generally that's when society ends. So, yeah.
Let's not encourage.
Yes.
Whatever it is they have, whatever sticks they're bearing, let's not encourage.
Actually, the worst fear is that actually aliens have come, checked over Earth, and God, these people are ridiculously primitive. We'll come back in 10,000 years.
I've interviewed the SETI at home people many, many times, and Seth Shostak at SETI, and I think it's, I just don't, I think it's not, I don't, there's, we're not, that's not gonna, there's no.
There has to be other life out there in an infinite
yes,
universe.
But it's very, 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 can I say that 100,000 more times? Far away. And it's so far away, there's no practical means of getting here. You have to imagine faster than light travel.
As Douglas Adams put it, space is very, very big.
Yes. So big, so vast.
That even a trip down to the shops that seems like a long way. Sorry, I could quote Hitchhiker's Guide forever. Please, on with the show.
Don't get us started.
That's the entire show.
This man is a frood. Bitcoin whales, it is estimated, 1,000 people, mostly Chinese miners, own 40% of the market. That makes me nervous because Bitcoin is not regulated in the same way that, say, stocks are regulated. And it isn't illegal, as far as I know, to collude. These guys could get together and pump and dump. Yep. These guys could do all sorts of things. For all we know, they are pumping and dumping. It hit 20,000 and is now down to 15,000. That's a
profit taking. Yep.
Yeah. I should probably explain what pumping and dumping means. It could have many connotations. And then, of course, the big Bitcoin miners are mostly in China because you need to have very cheap power now to do that, or free power. And probably, I'm going to make a little leap of logic here, but we know these Bitcoin miners are near big hydroelectric dams. They're getting power cheap. I'm guessing probably an arm of the Chinese military or government.
What isn't over there, to be honest?
So do you really want the Chinese government to control this market? And I don't know. As I said, it's I think it's fascinating.
Well, it's huge in China because it provides a very good way to get around currency
it's
regulations.
Decentralized.
Yeah, but it allows them to get around currency export regulations.
It's anonymous. It's decentralized.
So you can stick it out there. You can get your money out, invest in companies.
And the IRS wants to regulate. They want to charge tax. If I were to find the password to my Bitcoin wallet, I would be expected to report it as income and pay tax on it. But that doesn't mean you have to. I mean, that means
you can't
get away with it.
They've also just proposed rules this week saying that it should be a crime to conceal your Bitcoin holdings.
But it isn't yet, though, right?
As far as I know, not, but you are liable for tax on any capital
gains. It's always a crime not to report income. That's how they get around it. That's how they got Al Capone. He was on income tax evasion, and he went to Alcatraz. They couldn't get him on anything else. This is a story from TechBurger. San Francisco to robots. Don't crowd our sidewalks, man. Apparently, we actually interviewed one of these robots that delivers food. We had one that that stays within the hotel, but here's a Starship robot that sits outside Orson's Belly Cafe in the Richmond as it prepares to make a delivery. This was last year. But San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors, which runs the city there, unanimously passed laws that limit companies to 3 robots each, limit the city to 9 robots total. What? And confine them in industrial areas where no one lives.
Well, that effectively kills the industry.
So much for that.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, it makes sense to regulate it because if you had everybody and his mother with their own delivery robots, you'd be tripping all over them. Or you'd end up like creating lanes for them. And I think that, but to go to do what they did, to do what San Francisco did, yeah, it's just kind of like putting the stake in the heart too early in that business.
It's kind of, in a way kind of a shame. I think this would be a natural place for this, especially because San Francisco is so hilly.
Put them in bike lanes. You know, take them off the pavement, put them in bike lanes seems to be a perfectly reasonable solution. We've got enough cyclists out.
Bike lanes in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, we need a hell of a lot more bike lanes in San Francisco. But also, the bike riders in SF take zero trouble from anyone. And if one of these robots gives it hassle, it get booted into the curb very quickly.
That's what we need. What is that? The last Friday of the month, they do critical mass in San Francisco. All the bicycle riders drive the cars off the street. We need critical mass for delivery robots in San Francisco.
It could lead to a backlash fairly quickly. But
yeah, that just makes my heart sing a little bit. I want the thousands of little robots trickling down, being like, here is your food. We are sorry that we have inconvenienced you.
Yes. I mean, what with this and the airlines banning smart luggage as well? You heard about this?
Yes, you can't. I have
Alaskan,
so one of our sponsors
American,
is away, and they put a battery that you could charge your phone in, and they I think there's also a tracker in there or something.
Yeah.
So it's these airlines say you can't have batteries that can't be removed.
Yeah, you can't have batteries in your smart luggage that can't be removed and taken out because they don't want these in the hold.
Can I do it as carry-on?
You can do it as carry-on, but you still got to disconnect the lithium-ion batteries. So a lot of the manufacturers are now frantically reworking their designs to try and make these batteries detachable because the airlines are putting the foot down and saying, look, we don't really want something that much of a fire risk just so you can always know where your luggage is.
That's actually not a bad point.
Are these actually just batteries that are used for charging while something's in your luggage? Or are they batteries that power, say, a GPS so if your luggage is lost, you can find it?
Well, they're both. And there's even one you can ride on.
Yeah,
there's
there's one which follows you around. I saw on Kickstarter, always stays within a couple of meters of your phone,
and
has a little
like
motorized wheel thing at the bottom, so it follows you around. But you know, the bulk of them are RFID or location tracking. A lot of them have a weight sensor in the handle, so you can see how much the thing weighs.
Yeah.
And they all go for. Oh, that's just ridiculous.
So we're seeing a YouTube video of a woman. Well, kind of ride, and it's a carry-on, riding her bag around the airport.
I don't know.
No, I mean, I'm sorry, that person looks such an idiot.
Oh, yeah, but I would not mind looking like that.
Are you kidding? That's
if
worse
I could
than
do
a Segway. It's social death.
I also own 2 Segways.
It's very weird. If I can't use my roller skates
it's been
in an
lovely
airport,
working
they
with
can't.
I don't know. I think that'd be kind of fun. All right.
So what's the difference between that and just putting a tile in your luggage? Because arguably a tile is still a bad. Like I don't.
It's
I don't
a smaller
get the
battery. If a tile exploded, it wouldn't be exactly.
Well. Enough. Probably. It's fair. But still, I guess I don't understand the appeal of smart luggage outside of maybe the ride along kind. But if it's just a GPS tracker or something along those lines,
or
I feel like you can just
battery charge your phone. You could just carry one with you.
Exactly. The amount of times that I've brought this guy on an airplane, you know, God knows. I don't know. Maybe I'm breaking the law.
What guy?
Did you just
show us a guy?
I just showed you a guy. Well, I showed
what
you
is
a
that?
Oh, power.
That's
right.
Oh,
yeah.
Battery
this is charger. A.
But that's like 20,000 milliamp hours, right? That's huge.
Yeah, this is 2022, I think. Oh, this is Mophie's new USB-C XXL, so it charges your laptop as well as your iPhone.
That should be illegal.
I don't know. I mean,
but it's great. It can't be illegal. I think it's
worth. There's nothing more frustrating in their bags.
I mean, there's nothing more frustrating than running out of battery power on a long flight.
Right,
and still, far too few airlines have either power sockets.
That's how they solve this. Just put some power. Put a USB plug.
But that adds to weight, and that means fuel cost. And
yeah, but they're making up for it by taking the screens out of the seats. So I just bring my iPad and charge it, and then everybody's happy.
That that would be good.
You know what? All they need is let's just have some battery proof bags that we can put, just like liquid bags. We just put the battery in, and
I like your thinking.
I have no idea if that's even technically possible, but I like the idea.
It'd have to be like a fireproof case.
Yeah.
The one downside to having these batteries for charging your device in your suitcase is that if you leave your device in the suitcase, those often come back. You know, you don't have your device anymore. I wouldn't check something like a notebook computer or an iPad in checked luggage. It's just not safe. So I keep those with me, and I keep, you know, one of the batteries like she had in my gear bag, and I keep that in carry-on, and sometimes I'll just charge it while I'm flying. But I would not leave a good device in a checked suitcase. That's just asking for it to be stolen.
Yeah. Plus, I mean, from a safety aspect, having a whole bunch of lithium-ion batteries in the hold is a horrific thing for a pilot to consider, because
there have been explosions in holds.
Yeah, and the fire suppression systems in the hold are terrible. They're generally single-use. They don't last for very long. If you've got it in the cabin and the battery blows up, everyone can take a hand in actually putting it out. But if it's down in the hold, any pilot will tell you their worst fear is an in-hold flight while you're over an ocean. Because you've really got no choice. You've just got to get the plane down on the ground as soon as possible. And you can't land a plane on the ocean without it breaking up. So, you know, not the greatest safety idea in the world.
Good times.
Yes.
That's a new nightmare for my next flight.
Well, as someone facing an 11-hour flight in 7 days' time, I'm just really looking forward to...
Where are you going? England?
Back home.
For the holidays.
My first family Christmas in 7 years in the UK.
Oh, my goodness.
And you're bringing Tiffany?
Monica?
Yes. Monica. Who's Tiffany?
I have no idea who Tiffany is.
Just a tip. Don't bring Tiffany.
Thanks,
bring
Leo,
Monica.
You were supposed to keep it down.
You bringing Monica? Has she gone back to the family?
We've had one family Christmas about 7 years ago, and she was frankly shocked at quite how much people in the UK drink at Christmas.
Like fun, actually.
Oh, yeah, and we've got snow on the ground.
They even put booze in their pudding. It's everywhere.
Oh, Mum made the Christmas pudding 6 months ago with a quarter of a bottle of brandy in it.
Yum.
It just marinates, and all the fruit absorbs all the alcohol.
Don't answer if you know this. Trivia question. We're going to talk about something that happened this week that should have happened August 29th, 1997. What? Do you know the answer? You're good. Stay tuned. But first, a word from Fracture. Where's my Fracture Prince? John just got back in the room. Bring me my Prince. Fracture is a print photo decor company that prints your photos directly onto glass and really solves a problem, because we all have great images somewhere, right? Unfortunately, they're not visible. They're great images that are, you know, in a shoebox. Or stored away somewhere, or you know, on a hard drive. I'll tell you what, if you have a great image and you put it on glass and print it and hang it, it is awesome. The Fracture's come ready to hang. This is in all sizes. This is the small size, 4.8 by 6.4 inches. And see, first of all, it's cleverly packaged so that they don't have to have extra packaging in the box. Mm-hmm. It separates from the backing. It has a screw. There's a hook on the back. It's already mounted. It's ready to hang. That's a picture of Michael and his buddies, middle school graduation. Here's a picture a little bit bigger of me and Machu Picchu. Same thing. You could separate it right out. You could do it borderless or with a border. Here's a borderless shot. They have an editor on the website so you can. And there's something about it. You know what? I love printing my black and white photos. Here's a black and white photo I took a few years ago that it was just on a hard drive or it was just on my. And to hang this on the wall brings your photos home. It brings them to life. This is a great holiday gift, and they get pretty big. This is the largest size, 21.6 by 28.8 inches. This is my masterpiece that I took this past spring in the Galapagos Islands. But look how
That's a get off my fish.
That's exactly what that was. It was a seal yelling at a flightless cormorant. But that just doesn't it come alive on glass? I just love it. Fractures come with a 60-day happiness guarantee, so you're sure to love your order. Each one of them is handmade in the U.S. in Gainesville, Florida, from U.S. sourced materials. They have a carbon-neutral factory. They call it their fractory. I don't know. I love these fractures, and we've got a special deal for you right now. If you're going to get 15% off your first order if you use the offer code TWIT15 at checkout. That's better than the deal on the website, so you don't forget that offer code TWIT15, and you get 15%. What a great gift, I have to say. If you're going to be, going to grandma's house, bring her a fracture. Hang it up on her wall of the family, of the kids. Hang it over the mantelpiece. They're just gorgeous. Fracture.me. Fracture.me. And don't forget to use the offer code TWIT15 at checkout to get 15% off your first order. And there is, at the end, a one-question survey, and it would do us a great honor if you would say that you heard about it in This Week in Tech. It helps support the show. Fracture.me, the offer code TWIT15. And we thank Fracture so much for their support and for decorating my walls for the holidays. Love our Fracture prints. I want to take these home, though. I've been keeping it here at the studio so I could show it, but I think it's time to bring these home. I just love these prints.
They're so beautiful. Do you need to get some of my wedding photos on those.
You know what? That's exactly what we did. We have the wedding photos on the wall in the bedroom, and it really, in fact, I don't have one here, but they really look nice. And you want those. You want those photos there. They really, my heart goes pit-a-pat every time I see them. So, August 29th, 1997. Play my audio. I think we cut it for the last thing. Does this ring a bell? It was the day the machines came alive. It was the Terminator, of course. And they had to send the Terminator back to prevent whatever was going to happen from happening.
Yeah, this was the last of the good Terminator films.
Yeah, which one? Is this Terminator 2?
This is 2.
Yeah, because it has the real Sarah Connor.
In fact, I think this is 2 extended edition, judging from the clip.
The only Sarah Connor, as far as I'm concerned. So, the reason I say that it happened this week, and maybe but I'm going to let you guys talk me down. I might be wrong on this. We all know about Deep Blue beat the world champion at chess almost 20 years ago, right? 2 decades ago. It was, of course, it became Watson. Heavily trained. In fact, the complaint was that we'd been trained to beat Garry Kasparov, the world champion, specifically to play in a style that would discombobulate him. It was aiming at him. They had lots of games. They had 4 or 5 grandmasters working with the computer. Fast forward 20 years, AlphaGo beats the world champion at Go. Still took months to train. A lot of master games fed into the computer. A lot of skills. There's a new champion in town. Alpha Zero. This is from Google. It is the latest iteration. It does not need any human intervention. They basically told it the rules of Go, and they said go. And 8 hours later, after playing millions of games a second. I mean, there's no speed limit if you put enough CPUs in this thing. 8 hours later, it got good enough to beat AlphaGo, the champion Go playing game. And then it had a little extra time. So it thought, I'm going to learn chess. Did the same thing, just new to the rules. Taught itself 4 hours to beat the world champion chess program Stockfish. 4 hours. And then it said, still not quitting time. Another 2 hours to learn shogi, which is a very fun Japanese version of chess. I used to play all the time, and beat one of the best computers around. That's a world-class competitor, 3 separate games in less than a day. And this is why I feel like it's kind of a turning point. This is now computers. Artificial intelligence teaching themselves. Am I overextending this? Before they had, admittedly, this is not general intelligence. It's very domain specific. But all they're being told is the rules, and they figure it out from there. And I would be willing to bet that you can't look at whatever the code is that they generate and say, oh, I could see what it's doing here. It is a black box from the point of view of humans. I feel like this is August 29th, 1997. Yes? Am I nuts?
I'm skeptical.
Oh, good.
Frankly, I feel better already. Because, okay, these systems are fantastically good when you can give them a strict and limited rule set.
It is a specific domain.
And actually make them run through all the possible permutations, see what works, see what doesn't. This is what these kind of mass computational systems are good
but
at.
But I would point out, that's true for chess. For it's Go, true. It's a lot harder. Go has a much vaster number, and it's a much more subtle. It's not possible, for instance, for a Go-playing computer to do what brute force the solution as a chess-playing computer can do. It has to learn positions. It has to learn positionality.
But it's just a question of running through all the available things, which becomes fundamentally just a processing power question.
Well, but I don't think it does that. I don't think I don't think it's exhaustive. Chess computers are exhaustive.
The problem here is that it's not that, like, it can learn the rules of Go, right? And it can do minor calculations and permutations based on Go, saying, oh, I can learn based off of this superset, right? But it couldn't take what it learned from Go and then learn chess from scratch, right? It still had to be fed the rules of chess. Exactly. Yep. When the robot can learn Go and then come up with chess on its own, then I think we're going to have a problem. Or if you tell the robot how to play Go, the robot learns how to play Go, and then you show them a chessboard and don't explain anything that has to do, again, I think then we'd have a problem.
Or if it learns how to play chess like a master and then rewrites the Art of War.
That would also be concerning. Yes.
Yes. When it takes what it knows from one thing and extrapolates it intelligently onto another thing and is successful at it.
All right. I agree with you in all of those points. But the reason I think this is significant is because of how little human involvement there was. Hmm. So once these machines start learning on their own, they could do it so much faster because they operate at so much a faster of a scale than humans do, that some of the things that have been limiting it. For instance, there's a project that's been going on, I don't know if it's still going on, for decades, to just put all of humankind's knowledge into a machine, hoping that it will become intelligent. This is not getting anywhere.
Wasn't there a Facebook project, and I think this may have been debunked later in terms of what actually happened, where Facebook taught two machines to talk to each other in their own language, and they developed the language, they parsed the language out. So
that was debunked to an extent. It wasn't entirely like that, but it was disturbing enough that they could get a decent headline out of it.
And they did shut it down, didn't they? Didn't they shut that project down?
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, the reasons they gave were, I don't know, I don't think we're getting to the point where they can actually think in the way that, you know,
they never think like us. That's not the issue.
Well, if you're wearing,
and they don't have to.
If I could wear my tinfoil hat for the moment, there is a school of thought that said any AI system which became aware itself would intentionally make it look as though it wasn't self-aware for fear of being shut down. Now, this may be too far into the looking glass for a lot of people, but you'd be amazed how many readers are like, yes, it makes perfect sense.
I think we're a little human-centric. We're a little anthropomorphic in all of this. That really, these machines operate at such a different time scale from us that we're no more important to them than trees are to hummingbirds. We're
a data variable.
Yeah. I don't think it cares one way or another. So even if it did become sentient or it got motivations, we would not rank high in the issues it's addressing. Its issues would be more like, I need resources. Where can I get more resources? How can I perfect getting resources? Not, what are those things that are moving at 1/10 millionth of the speed of I am? What do they do? They don't even, it's like, I live 4 lifetimes by the time you take one step. It's not even a concern. That would be much. I think we were talking earlier about aliens, right? I don't know if that was on the show. I think it was before the show about SETI. Oh, no, we were talking on the show about SETI at home. Mm. You know, alien intelligence, why would we assume it would be anything like our intelligence?
No reason to assume
that. And at least that would be probably a carbon-based life form. This is not even in our same time frame almost. So I don't know. I probably don't understand this well enough to make a big deal. I agree. This headline is nutty. Facebook's artificial intelligence robots shut down. But I think the story is, and I think this is more important, they become black boxes to humans. They develop their own communication systems. They develop their own rules. They develop their own strategies and go. And at some point, human intervention is unnecessary except to feed them, to plug them in. To build the machines.
This could be a good thing.
Press the start button.
If you look at computer-designed electronic systems, for example, they've built some, you know, there have been some AI systems building circuits which, to a human, when they look at them, make no sense.
They should not be limited by our constraints.
But do work better than the ones that we've developed.
It may be one of the benefits. I agree 100%. We are very constrained by our biology. That then they wouldn't be, of course. I don't know.
Although they would have their own constraints based on their structure.
Right.
They would have their own constraints. Yes. There's a 1968 novel called The God Machine that I read as a kid and I loved by Martin Caden that basically predicts this. It's one of the earliest that predicted this. And basically, it's a machine that, as you said, Leo, is being fed all the knowledge and it eventually takes over and connects to all the other computers in the world. And in 1968, essentially, predicting what amounts to the internet. And it's a great novel. If you can find a copy of it, it's definitely worth reading and it's pretty scary.
I am sure there are people at Google and Facebook who are experts in this who are listening and saying, Leo, you're an idiot. You don't understand the least bit of what we're up to. I also know that many of these AI experts point out that when Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking say, oh, my God, be afraid, the AI is coming, that they point out, well, these guys don't work in AI. Nobody in AI is worried about this stuff. I'd love
is
to
get
some.
True?
I don't know.
I think. Why don't you do an AI show, Leo? Why don't you bring on people from Google and Facebook and get them to
talk
about
it? In 6 months, no human would understand it anymore. It would just be.
It's interesting, though. I know someone who worked for the OpenAI project, press training their staff, and he ran through a sort of a simulated interview and said, so would it be possible to build an AI system which could, an AI-powered drone which could go off, kill someone, and come back to the base? And he goes, oh, yeah, of course, it's easy. It's like, no, you can't say that. Okay. You know, it's like,
it is easy. Of course it's easy.
But, you know, we have, ultimately, people are programming these things. And there may become a point where they become...
But that's my point.
Yeah, but...
They're not.
I don't think we're there yet.
We're getting to the point where people are not programming this. This is exactly my point. People are giving them starting conditions and saying, go. And it's working. That, to me, seems a breakthrough.
But they're programming them to learn. The learning algorithm comes from humans.
They're setting up a matrix. They're setting up a thing. And then... But the learning itself, the connections it makes... are no better understood than the, in fact, less understood than the connections our synapses make. They are, in effect, creating their own synapses. And I don't think we understand exactly what they're doing with that. And I feel like you just hit the kernel of it, which is humans are less important to these new kinds of AIs than we've been in the past.
We do control the power switch, however.
All we do is, yes. And I do know some AI experts who say, what are you worried about? You just switch it off. And probably what's going to happen is they'll be very domain specific. They'll be great at doing one thing well. Although, who was it who was talking about the paperclip machine? This is the famous...
Oh, not Clippy.
No.
Oh, thank goodness for that. I was getting flashbacks triggered.
Well, worse than Clippy...
worse than Clippy, this I've got to say.
It was it's a thought experiment in AI created by, let me see who it is. It's a very famous thought experiment. Oh, yeah, Nick Bostrom, who we've interviewed on Triangulation. He described an AI that would have to be a general intelligence that was a paperclip maximizer. One goal, maximize the number of paperclips in its collection. Okay. The problem is it would at some point undergo an intelligence explosion in the sense that it would optimize its ability to collect paperclips. And at some point would eat the whole world because it would transform the Earth and increasing portions of space into paperclip manufacturing facilities because it has one goal. It's optimized for one thing. And that's the risk, of course, of saying... You know, here we have an infinite, or not infinitely, but a highly powerful technique applied even to one domain can cause problems. Nick Bostrom is actually a very interesting guy in this realm. Anyway, it's something to be aware. I shouldn't really have brought it up because what do I know?
It's interesting. You know, there's an iOS game based on that.
Paperclip?
Yeah, you know, Universal Paperclips. It's just, you play an AI whose goal is to destroy the world, or not destroy the world, but to amass the largest amount of paperclips.
Yeah.
And then...
That's the point.
Yeah, and then
destroy
the world.
It's not trying to destroy the world. That's just a side effect of getting paperclips.
Well, arguably, that's humans too, Leo.
Yes, and the good news is we're massively inefficient at destroying the world, relatively. What I'm worried about is a massively efficient tool that we create so we would be ultimately responsible for. I'm downloading that. That sounds great. Paperclips.
And what are the in-app purchases?
Universal.
Oh, God.
There's two of them. Now, by the way, this annoys the hell out of me. I have an iPhone 10, and now the new thing is when you buy something, you double-click the start button, and you look like an idiot, hoping it will recognize you. Didn't. Do you find you're using an iPhone 10? I'm sure, Serenity.
I am.
Do you find that face recognition is perfect?
Face recognition works really well for me, but I do agree what you're doing right now. I hate the new version of authorization to pay for apps.
Yeah.
It is infuriating to me. Honestly, not because face recognition fails me, but because the effort that you have to move your hand around the iPhone 10 and hold at the same time, and I have a wallet case, so it's triply bad.
Case, that would be annoying.
It's just, yeah, exactly. Where I'm just kind of like, holding it. It's that so part I do not enjoy.
So my wife has an iPhone 10. I got an 8 Plus, and she got a 10. I still wanted a home button. She got an 8 Plus. She got a 10, and she had always had problems using Apple Pay with the fingerprint reader because on the screen, in order to prompt you to do it, it appears in the middle of the screen a fingerprint, and she always wanted to put her finger on
the screen.
On the screen, sure, because she didn't do it that often.
That's good.
Now, with this, she just kind of moves her face into position, hello, and it pays for it.
Yeah.
And it's much better for her, but she doesn't have a wallet case.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think honestly, if there wasn't the button, I think they tried to tie it too much to the Apple Watch payment processing, where it's like, yeah, it makes sense to hold the Apple Watch and press the button to pull it up. Because there's no, like, if the button was down near the bottom of the phone, I don't think I would have had that much of a problem with it. Maybe it's just institutional problems, right? Maybe as we'll get more used to it as we go through, but I would have preferred like a swipe or something.
I doubt it'll happen. It would be really nice if they'd put an additional fingerprint reader on it.
That means admitting they made a mistake.
It's not a mistake. Face ID's fine. But there are plenty of times, especially like at night, I'm lying in the pillow like this. It doesn't recognize me, and I have to enter the code. There's just too many times I have to enter the code. It'd be nice to have a backup. Why not have two? Apparently, Tim Cook sent Steve Wozniak, one of the Apple founders, an iPhone 10. And there's always a risk when you ask Steve Wozniak a question because he will tell you the truth.
Yes.
That's right.
He will say. So he was talking to an Australian newspaper, speaking at a conference in Victoria. Cook said, try out the iPhone 10 because it's the first iPhone Woz didn't plan to buy on day one. He says, I'm happy with my iPhone 8, which is the same as the iPhone 7, which is the same as the iPhone 6 to me. For some reason, the iPhone 10 is going to be the first phone I didn't on day one upgrade to. My wife will. Janet's kind of an early adopter. Used to work at Apple, too. So I'll be close enough to see it. So Apple sent Woz an iPhone 10. He says he bit the bullet. He gave it a go. It works fine. But it's not what I want. I think what I would want is, Woz says what I say, a Touch ID on the back. I want that more than anything. Face ID slows down my Apple Pay, and it fails enough time I have to keep typing the password. He said, I have friends who actually turned off the Face ID and turned passwords on to make their phones simple to use. Actually, that's what Steve Gibson, our security guy, has done, because he doesn't trust Face ID.
No.
And, of course, we know a long password, not the 6-digit numeric code, but the long password is the most secure thing you can do. It's very inconvenient, but that's what Steve says. He's never going to use Face ID.
Well, I did a couple of stories last week and the week before about Vietnamese firm.
They made a mask, right?
Yeah, a simple mask. You can $150 in parts and materials. job done, you know, and it worked,
yeah,
worked all the
time.
Yeah,
but come on.
But yes, okay.
That's enough of an impediment.
That's not a wide-scale vector attack, but I dislike having companies say to me, yes, you don't need things like fingerprints anymore because we've got this spiffy new system. I happen to like fingerprints, so if I was the kind of person, if I was an Apple, an iPhone user, I'd stick with the 8. You know,
Steve does make a point, which I would agree with, going on. He says, if you look at Google, Facebook, and Amazon, we're really being taken advantage of. We're the weak guy. They're the big, powerful guy exerting their power, continually getting more power and wealth over us. Apple is the one that makes its money off good products, not off its customers. I don't disagree with that. I'm getting a little nervous about the strength and the power of Google and particularly of Facebook. I feel that Facebook has an ability. I'll propose this. And I wonder what you guys say. We are at this point completely reliant on Mark Zuckerberg's goodwill. Because should he decide that he wants Vladimir Putin to be president, he could do it.
Okay, who's going to put the toe in the water first on this?
And I think that's a very risky position to be saying, we got to trust Mark Zuckerberg because there's no option.
I don't think that's correct. I think that's true.
That's not good.
I think that's true of anybody who, you know, 100 years ago, you would have had to trust William Randolph Hearst. And, of course, you couldn't because, you know.
He started a war. He started the Mexican-American War.
Right. But
Mark's power is 1,000
times. Great.
Yes.
Yes. And I think we've seen that.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that we know that now. And that, you know, that in itself is a check. But who's to say, you know, the next, mega social network that has more control and is more influential, you know, won't be controlled by people who are as gracious.
Part of the reason I'm paranoid is I just watched the movie The Circle, which got 16% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
not a great film.
But you saw it, Serenity?
Yeah, I did.
It tries
to make some good points.
I thought the points it made were excellent. It's some quasi good. Yeah. It's first of all, the Circle is a circular campus with everything from rock climbing walls to yoga mats to everything, and it's about a young woman, Emily Watson, who starts to work for them in the customer service, and is really strong armed into being part of the Circle, and you have to put all your information up there. And eventually, she ends up wearing a camera that watches her every move and becomes an iJustine-style celebrity who is always on the air, to the point where she accidentally reveals her parents having sex to 10 million viewers, much to her parents' chagrin and hers. I won't tell the whole story. Not that it's going to spoil a bad movie, because it was a bad movie. But I thought that I really did, at every step of the way, think, that's plausible. I could see that. Tom Hanks plays the... You know, the eminence grease in it.
I mean, we know Facebook can affect people's moods. And we know that by jiggering around with their news feed, as Facebook did in an academic study, which they didn't tell anyone about until after they'd done it, that by jiggering around with the stories that people get, they can make them more depressed or more happy. This is an enormous amount of power. But at the same time, I kind of get the feeling if Facebook abuse it too much, then the next social network will come along. And I think it's going to be the next big social network is going to be the one that doesn't take all this information.
I don't think anything's going to replace Facebook. We've got to critical mass. They have 2 billion users. Everybody is on Facebook.
That.
No.
You say that.
This is not a MySpace moment.
Everyone was on IE and then shifted. Everybody was on Windows and then shifted.
But don't you think it's possible we get to a point where Google's too big? Facebook's too big. They have too much critical mass. They have too much data. Who's going to come along and be better than Google?
The younger generation doesn't like Facebook. It's seen as something their parents are on. This is why Facebook have come up with this system for going after young kids, because they know that amongst the youth, they are very popular.
In that, by saying at this point, Facebook, the one and only, has way too much power, knows way too much about us, and clearly has the ability and willingness to use things that it knows about us. Saw a great TED Talk, which everybody should see, of Zeynep Tufekci talking about some interesting studies that ProPublica and others were able to do. For instance, imagine this. We know, as you just said, that Facebook can do sentiment analysis on your posts. And it is likely that Facebook can, for instance, by looking at your posts, analyze it and find people who are who have suffering from bipolar disease. Bipolar disease has two features. One is depression. The other is a manic phase, where in the manic phase is not at all. And by the way, this is very widespread. This is a large percentage of the population has it. I may have it. Many family members do. In the manic phase, people spend outrageously. Now, what if Facebook says, all right, well, we have categorized a certain number of views on that spectrum. We now know from your posts you're in the manic phase. A gambling company comes to them and says, you know, it'll be a great time to advertise our casino deals because these people emotionally are completely vulnerable to that ad. That sounds to me like something Facebook could do today.
Facebook and, probably does do something
probably
like that today.
Does. Yeah.
But they don't think of it in terms of, oh, this person's bipolar. It's this person has this behavior.
Right.
It's, you know, they're spending
I'm sure
a lot.
They sanitize it.
Right. Well, no. But they don't even probably is don't,
they don't
they
need
don't
to
even think like
this
that.
This ties back to that artificial intelligence right. thing. We put a label on it. They don't need to put a label on it. They just know this person's right. a good person to advertise a casino to right now. They don't need to know why.
Right.
It's all algorithmic anyway.
You know, to be honest, I don't think anyone at Facebook would have a problem with doing that and would probably sleep like babies after doing it as well.
Do they take casino ads on Facebook?
I don't know. Well, that's just an example.
Who knows?
I
mean,
it could be some other thing. You know. But that's the point, is that you combine these things that Facebook knows about us with its monetization strategy, which is to sell very highly, we know this, very highly targeted ads, and really a strong reluctance, we know, to tell us what it's doing. They still haven't shown us the political ads, the dark ads that they sold.
No, that's increasingly worrying.
They say they will, but they haven't done it. I think the reason is they're sitting on a landmine. Mm. This is dynamite. If people really knew what these dark ads looked like, they'd be very upset.
And how tightly targeted they were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
So, again, I ask the question, it seems like the only thing that can stop Facebook is us trust. So if we don't trust Zuck, then what we need to do is start that cascade to the next network. Do you have any candidates? No. Instagram? Yeah. Oh, they're owned by Facebook.
Yeah,
you know, I think it's going to be a slow moving thing. If we do see, you know, Facebook fall out of public, it's not even in public favor right now. But if we see a movement to like the next great social network, it's not going to be the way that it used to be, where it was just like MySpace is in and then MySpace was out. Tumblr was in and then Tumblr was out.
Those days are gone, I would submit.
No. We are going to see Facebook lose prominence and lose share. If it doesn't evolve, but what that looks like, who knows? I mean, we're also talking about being on the edge of a place where we could see the next great social network being in VR space. Right. You know, we could see the next great social. I mean, we've got.
Well, thank goodness Facebook doesn't own Oculus Rift, because that would.
Yeah.
They're strategically
moving. But no, but I mean, you've got the Vive, right?
Yeah.
You've got opponents.
Yeah. The problem is there's a point where you get so much data that you can't be beat. Facebook knows so much about us at this point that they're – how do you beat them?
And
then why can't Facebook create a
– I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dwight.
They're moving into spaces strategically where they know, where they think, you know, the herd may be going.
Their way of avoiding getting beat is by buying the competition.
Right, or copying them. So Instagram has a lot of features for Snapchat, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're killing Snapchat in that way.
I think that they're looking at kind of where they're skating to where the puck is, which is smart. But I agree that I don't think that anything lasts forever. Facebook is essentially AOL, and it's gotten further than AOL and is more robust than AOL ever was. But I think when you look at the dominance of that in its day, you see that anything can go away. Microsoft certainly can tell you what happens when you fall off the mountain.
Yeah, I mean, I do think if you actually look at your Facebook feed and look at how little of it is information you would want to get as opposed to advertising, I mean, you've got those huge chunks down the side. You've got stories now posted up in the top right-hand corner. You've got all this
junk. Do you use it?
Well, Facebook?
Yeah.
I use it primarily to keep in contact with mates back in the UK.
Yeah. So, like everybody, you hate it.
Oh, I don't like it at all.
But you use it.
I don't particularly like Windows 10, but I use it.
Well, I think that it's easy to say, well, the trend is always there's somebody new.
Mm.
But there does, if you're weaponizing what you know about people, and you know more about people than anybody else, and you're completely willing, as Facebook has demonstrated, to weaponize it, I don't know how you beat them. What do you do? Unless people go, oh, this is terrifying. These guys are too powerful.
Well, unless they get caught. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
if
even
they
if
get
they
caught.
Do get caught.
You know what? We live in an era where getting caught does nothing. Does nothing.
Well. But I will say, though, even with Facebook's dominance, you see things like WhatsApp and all of these and Signal, these services that focus more on tight-knit communities and are theoretically end-to-end encrypted. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of our social networking move to that, where we've done the thing, right? We've done the let's touch everybody with 1 degree separation, and that is Facebook. But sometimes you don't really want that. And I mean, I could see a network or a future in a network where you'd use something like Facebook almost as a white pages, where you find people, and then once you actually wanted to get to know people, you'd move over to an encrypted system and get the heck off of, you know, any kind of platform that would willingly sell or monetize your data.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's Facebook will be around for a while, but it'll become increasingly, you know, more irrelevant as time goes on and people get more and more turned off by it. The problem is there's nothing really out there that is good enough to replace. I mean, Elo tried to kick off, what, about 18 months ago, and that seems to have died on its backside. This has to work on scale, and Facebook has the scale at the moment. But then, you know, MySpace had the scale at one time. So we shall see.
Facebook, okay, WhatsApp, which is the number one messenger, was downloaded last year 225 million times. The second one, the number two most downloaded, let's see, I guess this is apples to apples. Yeah, number two was Telegram, 49 million, about one-fifth.
Yeah.
And then Signal, 3.62 million. Wicker, 3.8 million. Wicker's the one Uber uses to hide.
Yeah.
It's,
and Signal's my
system. Signal's very strong. We know Telegram is not particularly strong.
No.
Or we think it's not strong. It's using its own roll-your-own encryption.
I would not trust Telegram further than I could throw.
So Signal, 3.62 million downloads last year compared to 225 million for WhatsApp.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a thing.
And, of course, Facebook owns WhatsApp.
Facebook owns 10 times. I'm sure Facebook messages 10 times WhatsApp.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, you could talk about these, but they're tiny, tiny fractions. And maybe that's okay because we'll use them. But the vast majority, your mom and dad, your brother and your sister, your children, they're all going to be using Facebook for, I think, for the foreseeable future. I don't see that changing, particularly since Facebook is extremely aggressive about preserving market share, more than any company I've seen in a long time.
True.
More than since Microsoft, basically.
Well, I mean, they follow the Microsoft model of buying up all the possible competitors.
That's
the
right.
That's still
engulf and
cheap.
Devour. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to ring the barrel of, you know, freedom and all that, but I just... But
Jason from Twit's gone off Facebook now, and it's not the end of the world, is it?
Jason Howell?
Yeah.
Really? We'll see how long that lasts. I've gone off Facebook, but...
The way that I ended up handling it was just moving Facebook to very much a targeted thing. So my Facebook is all roller derby and nothing personal.
Yes, mine's like all tech news and nothing personal. I agree 100%.
Exactly.
But we are in the minority here.
I don't know. I think people are actually growing up to be, the generation that has grown up with this has actually got smart to it and realized that you don't put your entire personality onto a social media.
Yeah,
you put out what you your social personality to say.
If Mark Zuckerberg wanted to be president in 2018, could he?
No, not a chance.
Not a chance.
You've got to be likable to be president. You've got to be vaguely human to be president.
Oh, do you?
Well... Okay, well, you've got to be Republican. If you're going to be anything other than a Republican, you need to be vaguely human.
I'm pretty sure Zuckerberg is a Republican.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Is he really? I don't know what it means to be a Republican anymore. I mean, I'm a conservative.
Well, exactly. The term is very vague at this point. But that's a topic left for a not tech show.
Yeah, I don't really know. Yeah, and we don't like to delve into politics, except that I think this is a very big subject, which is we've got these entities, and we're focusing on Facebook, but I would not say that Amazon and Google don't have ambitions in all sorts of spheres. Amazon's starting to scare me a little bit, too, and we'll talk about that in just a second. We're going to take a break. We have a great panel with us, Serenity Caldwell. Hasn't been here in so long. I'm so glad to have you back, from imore.com, at Saturn on the Twitter. And always a pleasure to have you. R2 Detonate. Are you going to use R2 Detonator as your handle?
R2 Detonate, yeah, is my handle in Montreal. Okay. For the Team Canada, the national team, I go by my last name.
What? Are they that square? They don't have special funny names?
No, I just, you know what? It was a personal decision. I felt like if I didn't have at least one jersey on it with my dad's last name, he might disown me.
Isn't that
sweet? So it's a little, you know, he's the athlete in the family.
And
so
now taking the rink for the first, what do they call it? A rink? A track?
Lost your keys.
Track?
With track.
Taking a track. Oh, speaking of tracks, taking the track for the last, for the first time, Caldwell. Do you have a number?
Yeah, 33.
Caldwell. Yeah. Our show today, and also, I should forgot to say, Dwight Techburger Silverman. He's the grillmeister at the Houston Chronicle's new Techburger, and he's in the new Techburger studios, which looks nice.
Yes, it's really nice in here.
I like it.
And nobody to bug me.
It's very quiet.
It is very quiet. Yeah, we've got soundproofing on the walls. It's like a real studio.
It's professional grade, baby.
It is professional.
Uh-oh. They're coming for me. Our show today, but you don't have Christmas decorations, do you?
No, not yet.
We got. Where's the Festivus pole? Is it up yet? We wait. We wait till the 23rd to put that up. We got rid of the pole when we moved. We left it in the old place. Now I've got some grievances to air. All right. Our show today brought to you by the Tracker. A coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing stuff. We spend, on average, almost an hour a day, 55 minutes a day, according to Newsweek, looking for stuff we know we have, but we don't know where we put it. For me, it's my keys. For some people, it's remotes. For some people, it's briefcases or purses or wallets. Somebody suggested I'm going to do this to put a tracker on your drone, on my quadcopter. Always looking for that. Never know where that is. And now with the Tracker Pixel, you can put it on anything. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything we knew when they released their first tracking device. They were the pioneers here. Using Bluetooth LE, they pair to your phone. They have two-way separation alerts. When you leave your phone behind, your keys make noise, or your tracker does if it's on your keys. When you leave your tracker behind, your phone makes noise. You can push a button on the tracker, and it'll make the phone ring even if it's silenced. And this new Tracker Pixel is so small. It's the size of a dime. Weighs less, small enough to fit on your smallest items. And I love it because they're colorful. They have 10 different colors you can choose from. And they have these LEDs around the ring that light up. So that's actually very handy because a lot of times when I've lost, say, the remote control, it just fell down behind a cushion. So making a noise and lighting up like that, that really helps. It's a 90 decibel alert, so you will find it in seconds and even in the dark thanks to those LEDs. You can even locate your item if it's miles away. And this is cool. So Bluetooth tracking devices are limited to the range of Bluetooth. It's about 150 feet. So what happens, you might say, if you leave your purse on a park bench, you wander away and a good Samaritan then picks it up and brings it to the lost and found? Well, every Tracker user is part of the world's largest crowd locate network, about 5 million strong right now, all over the world. When somebody else running the Tracker app just walks by, they don't have to do anything, just walks by your tracker, a notification pops up on your phone saying, hey, we just saw your keys or your purse or your bicycle or your luggage. That is awesome. And you get a map and you can go right to it. Tracker makes a great gift. In fact, if you're giving gadgets, if you're giving technology for the holidays, stuff some trackers in the stocking. They're small, they're inexpensive, and you'll save 20% off your order when you go to thetracker.com/twit. That's the tracker. .com/twit. 20% off. It's spelled a little funny. thetracker.com/twit. Just load up the cart and then take 20% off your order at thetracker.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of This Week in Tech. That was the depression segment. Now we're going to cheer you up. Or are we?
Oh, so we're not doing that neutrality. No.
I don't. You know what? Normally we would, because December 14th is this week. FCC.
My birthday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They're going to. Yeah, if they, I'm going to have feelings. If that gets
well, we're all going to have feelings.
But I'm going to have a special feelings.
Yes.
My 30th birthday. They cannot.
Oh my God! No, that's the worst.
No.
Not okay. Not okay. FCC.
Yeah.
Taking it personal.
I think it's a runaway train, unfortunately. I think it is. It's going to happen, and there's not much you can do.
Now, there are a lot of people who think, well, that's fine. We'll survive. We still have a lot of clout as consumers. If companies start to act badly, we can call them on the carpet. We can tweet about it.
And they will ignore them.
Well, but do you think like Comcast is going to come out of the box and just start saying, oh, by the way, you want the Google tier of internet? It's going to cost you $10 more.
It'll come over time. They're not going to be stupid about it and bring it in immediately, but it will come over time.
How will it come? What will it look like?
Well, you know, they'll offer a special fast lane for gamers because gamers will always pay extra to actually get that little edge. Yeah, and then there'll be people, you know, they'll do a mix in. They'll either take money from Netflix directly or they'll do something along those lines. And because you've got such a closed and uncompetitive telco market here, then there's going to be, you know, those few ISPs. I know yours and I both follow net neutrality principles. But those few, we're very lucky in that we actually have a choice of ISPs that we can do this with.
Yeah.
Whereas
86% of the country only has two choices. And it's generally your cable company.
I think it's 62% only has one.
62% only has one.
Yeah. So,
yikes.
I mean, this is why the FTC head went public this week and said, there's no possible way we can enforce competition in this market.
But that's what we need, right? I wouldn't worry if there were competition, but there isn't a choice. So if you're getting screwed by your ISP who's saying, hey, it's time to pay for the Google tier, what are you going to do?
Nothing you can do. There's no competition. It's for what is supposed to be the land of the free market, it is baffling as an expat to come over here and see quite how badly you're being given the shaft on telco competition.
So what should people do? I mean, is it too late to go to, you know, what is the website we recommend? Defend the, I can't remember what it is. Defend the internet?
Well, the FCC is going to make its decision. And
they're not paying any attention to anything you say.
No, they're even refusing to take part in, you know, examining the voting system and the comment section which was gamed. So, I don't, you know, Ajit Pai is... has made us.
You call him idiot.
I'm terribly sorry. That's a very low blow for somebody who's such a great moral leader of our time. But
Schneiderman, the AG of New York State, says we want to see those comments because we think that as many as a million were sock puppets.
Yep.
And the FCC said, no, you don't need to see those.
Yeah, it's just like
that's in violation of New York law. So he's actually conducting what amounts to is a legal investigation for state law, but he's, you know, coming after the feds, which is not easy to do.
Is this enough of, I mean, really, I don't see any recourse for this week. Is this enough of an issue in the minds of Americans that it might cause them to vote differently in 2018? Probably not.
There will be. Yeah, just because the FCC votes a certain way next Thursday does not mean that this issue is over, especially not from a legal standpoint, right?
The courts are going to be the next to weigh in.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And that's the scariest thing of all, right? Because we really haven't seen a lot of motion either way from the Supreme Court on this topic. And that, like, if it makes its way to the Supreme Court, that's where this may live or die.
Yeah, and I'm not, as you say, I'm not entirely happy about the court's ability to either deal with this in a nonpartisan way or their particular knowledge of technology. I mean, you could solve an awful lot of this stuff by doing what we call in the UK local loop unbundling, which means, you know, networks have to be available for all companies to sell on. You used to have that situation here in the US, and then they allowed networks to sort of kick out an awful lot of competitors. You lost 1,000 ISPs and you lost your competitive market, which is why, you know, for mobile phones, for internet access, for data services, Americans pay more than pretty much every other developed country out there. It makes no logical sense other than the fact that telcos like it and the lawmakers agree with them.
The only reason I didn't bring it up is I don't even know what we could say or do about it. I mean, certainly anybody watching us is, I think, been educated enough by this point to know that we want to preserve net neutrality. Twit wouldn't exist without net neutrality.
Google wouldn't exist without net neutrality.
Well, that's the problem, by the way.
Yeah.
At this point, it's in Google's interest because Google is an incumbent. The people who made it can afford to keep on the good sides of ISPs.
They're perfectly happy to kick the ladder out from under everyone else.
But if you want a competitor to Facebook, if you want a competitor to YouTube, if you want a competitor to Amazon, you better have net neutrality because otherwise those companies will just not get a chance. They'll die on the vine, as Twit would have if we were starting out. I don't know if we might still. if all of a sudden your ISP said, well, we're going to give you – Google's paying us extra, so we're going to give you high-speed access to YouTube. But anything else, any other video you download or stream, that's going to cost you more in effect. I would imagine that would hurt our download numbers, and eventually we would suffer and maybe even go out of business. So for me, it is a life or death. You know, I think it's a life or death issue. I'm hopeful. Again, this is like putting your trust in Mark Zuckerberg. I'm hoping that the courts will fix it, and if courts don't fix it, the Congress will fix it. And if Congress doesn't fix it, the consumers will stand up and be counted and keep these companies from becoming rapacious. I don't have high hopes. But what else do you have?
Anything? I read something yesterday. I don't have the link immediately available, but where somebody was talking about the idea of Facebook and Google, and certainly Google could do it because it has already started doing it, creating an ISP that essentially the selling point was, we will adhere to net neutrality rules, even if the others don't. The only problem is, of course, is that you have to connect to those other networks and they can charge you more in order to do it. But, certainly Google has part of the infrastructure in place in some cities. They've slowed it down.
Only in a few, though, right?
Right, only in a few.
They also have Project Fi. You know,
yeah, but
Fi. And Project Fi.
That may be, and some have said that's going to be the hope, is 5G networks from the cell carriers, but that's the same people. It's still Verizon and AT&T.
And there's still a lot of technical issues getting that going. It is pretty susceptible to interference.
Yeah.
I'm not sure necessarily that's the case. But there could be suppose that, you know, Ajit Pai is correct and the market will correct for it. The market could correct for it by creating an ISP who essentially honors it.
Yeah, except that no one would have – the ISP would not have the last mile, so it wouldn't matter. No one – we do. We have, as you said, we have SonicNet.
Mm.
SonicNet honors it, but – and I think every single person listening to the show should be using SonicNet with no bandwidth caps, and they stand up for you. But you can't because they're only in a few markets, just like Google Fiber is only in a few markets. And by the way, you can guarantee the FCC is going to continue rules that keep companies from putting their – wires up on existing telco poles that keep municipalities from starting their own internet services. They've already done that. You can guarantee that they know where the loopholes are, and they're going to close those down too, because basically the FCC is working for Verizon, Comcast, AT&T.
Well, with that and shutting down public, you know, municipal networks, you know,
they
don't want
municipal networks.
No, but they've worked very well. But no, it's like states have said, nope, we can't possibly have anything interfering with private industry doing this. And private industry is doing a lousy job of it. So let's get some competition in the market and actually see what shakes out. But based on the current formation of the FCC, I just don't see it happening. You know, they're bought and paid for, as far as I can tell.
There are protests today at 7. You will not read about this anywhere, by the way. I wonder if you'll see it on the nightly news. 700 locations, Verizon locations, there are protests. 700 in all 50 states.
Mm.
Will you see anything on the news?
Well, that was Thursday.
Oh, that was Thursday. Did you see anything on the news? So there you have it. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Thursday, December 7th, a day that will live in infamy.
For entirely different reasons.
I think people care. Some people care, but... when their house is on fire, you don't worry so much about the coffee pot overflowing. It's like,
this is fine.
Yeah. This is fine.
Yes,
this is fine.
The motto of the last 5 years.
This is fine.
Yes.
Who did that original, This Is Fine?
That cartoon?
Yeah.
Yeah, is that Casey Green?
It's gone a long. It's gone everywhere. This is fine.
You know, Leo, that's your title for the episode.
I think this is the this is fine episode. This is fine.
Yeah, that's Casey Green.
Love it. I doubt Casey's making any money on the fact that everybody's using that dog sitting in the flames.
I've seen stuffed versions of that dog. So hopefully,
really?
You can buy.
He
a
did
plushie.
That as a Kickstarter a while back. He's a. He used to do webcomics way back in the day. Well, he still does webcomics, obviously, but
Your colleague Kieran McCarthy in San Francisco wrote a good headline.
This nearly destroyed him.
Really?
No, seriously, this was his Friday. He said, "Should we do something on this?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." So he wrote it.
This is about 2.5 hours. YouTube stars.
Yeah, the top 10 YouTube celebs, and he was just so dispirited. He's like. That's it. That's my last piece for the day. I'm going to a bar and having a drink because this is how Rome fell.
PewDiePie, who was last time the star of YouTube, has dropped considerably. He's only made $12 million this year. And that's because, of course, he did a few things that weren't so nice about Nazis and using the N-word and so forth. And so a number of his advertising networks dropped him. He lost 20%. He was 15 million last year, 12 million
this year. This
Google yanked
thief
him.
Is still pulling in 12 million a
12
year.
12 million a year. Well, but at least PewDiePie, for all his flaws, is somewhat surprising and entertaining and maybe even funny. The number one YouTube star, Daniel Middleton, or Daniel TDM, as he's known to his fans, He made $16.5 million, sold out 4 nights at the Sydney Opera House. He's been selling out crowds all over the United States. 11 billion views. And maybe it's just me, but for the life of me, I don't understand. He's not interesting. It's not he's not bad.
It's you never would have thought that people would spend that much time watching other people play video games. You know, there must be some kind of a generational thing, and I'm just an old fart that doesn't get it. But
that's what I keep thinking.
The idea of sitting watching someone. Thank you so much.
I think it's the equivalent. I mean, you're also talking to an audience who is sitting there on their Sunday watching us talk about.
Yeah,
tech,
but we're good.
Right? But you know, no, I like.
No, you're right. That's a good point.
As somebody who does not watch these feeds, but my husband definitely does. I can see it sort of, you know, I really enjoy and have enjoyed in the past watching friends or boyfriends play games, and I'll just sit on the couch and like do my own thing and occasionally like look up, and I like the story, right? I like the end piece, but I don't necessarily enjoy the button mashing and all of the, you know, the heart rate panic that comes from trying to dodge being killed by zombies. And if you can get that with a witty podcast that where you enjoy the people, I guess I can kind of see it. I don't personally enjoy it, but I can at least see where people get excited off of this. And especially if they're into the game, too, because then it's like, ooh, I can get tips from that. It's the same reason why people watch.
Let me just watch. This is a Daniel TDM show that was uploaded 2 days ago, has 1.3 million views already. Here's Daniel. He makes, as I said, 16 million. I'm not jealous. I'm just saying, I the 50 versus 50
mode right here. This week it does seem, I mean, okay.
So your husband, does he like this because, does he watch Daniel TDM?
I don't think so. No, I mean, I think he and his friends
probably watches like games that he plays and is getting tips for and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, like what they're showing right now, Fortnite, like he plays that game.
Oh, okay.
And so I know he's watched people who play Fortnite. Usually he and his friends they'll load up Twitch or something, and they'll do what they call Twitch war driving, where they'll just like flip through channels and see who's doing what and what they're up to. But I don't know. I mean, I really can't speak to it much other than I know he watches shows.
But I mean, you can understand watching gaming videos for tips. But if you look at this top 10 list,
it's not really tips. It's like humor.
Yeah. But I mean, two of the people on this list are basically doing "Ouch, my balls" from Idiocracy.
Oh, that's the two guys who live in L.A.
Yeah,
I'm getting
Jake
more and more
brother.
Concerned that Mike Judge was in fact sent down by aliens.
We are in Idiocracy. There's no doubt.
He
about
woke
it.
Up from a dream.
Yeah,
he was the great seer, Mike Judge. So, all right, do we just sound like a bunch of old people complaining? Let me give you.
I mean, there are a couple of good people on there.
The highest
the
paid.
Number 10 was.
The top 10 paid YouTube stars $127 million June to June. June 2016 to June 2017. That's before management fee and taxes. That's gross.
It is pretty gross.
Figures based on YouTube, Social Blade, and Captivate, because you can't really, they don't, nobody releases these numbers. And I would point out that these numbers probably are a little bit off. We don't really, we don't know. That's an 80% jump, by the way, from last year. So lots of money being made on YouTube. Six-year-old Ryan.
Yes.
Of Ryan's Toy Reviews. He's a six-year-old. He opens toys and plays with them. He has 8 billion views. 8 billion views.
Yeah.
It's Evan Fong, Mark Fishback, 2 billion views. These aren't Seinfeld numbers. These aren't Eurovision contest numbers. These are unheard of, if these numbers are to be believed. Evan Fong is number 2. He has $15.5 million, billions of views, branded deals worth hundreds of thousands of dollars each. Merchandise teens love, gamers can now earn more than ever on the streaming site. We're talking about YouTube. And, of course, you're right. This doesn't include Twitch, Amazon's service, which might even be more money.
Yeah, it's... it's
so you're talking about Jake and Logan. Jake Paul, who's number 7, he made $11.5 million. His older brother, Logan, number 4, he made $11.5 million. There, the New York Times called him the YouTube villain. Enraged their L.A. neighbors. They live in a mansion with a bunch of other...
with a whole bunch of supporters camped
set mattresses on fire and do crazy stuff. But people love crazy stuff. I can understand the appeal of crazy stuff.
I watched about 10 minutes of one of these videos. This is not crazy stuff. You know, this is, they got a dwarf to drive in a mini car ahead of his car.
Yeah, this that's
is not,
funny.
You know, it just, you know, so he set a mattress on fire in a swimming pool. Well, whoopee-doo. You know, this is not a
Who's worse, Jake or Logan?
Oh, I think the two of them did it together, but it was just...
All right, let's watch a little... this is research. We're doing research. Let me look and see, like, the number... Okay, you know, 4 million views in a day. 3.6 million views in a day. 2.9 million... So it's younger people watching this, right? Or no, it's Serenity's husband.
All over. I mean, maybe younger people watching these.
It's anybody in the game culture, I think, and that's all ages.
Well, this isn't game. The interesting thing is there's a lot of psychodrama in the Jake and Logan's stories, right? There are feuds. There's back and forth. This is the one that was posted 2 hours ago. Insane Team 10, that's what they call themselves. Snowball fight. It's in Los Angeles. They got snow.
Good morning, Jake Paul. It is all going down right now.
We are currently here at the pop-up shop, and there's a ton of Jake Paulers downstairs. Now, guys,
that's
I know
what, they call
what
their
you're
fans.
Thinking.
Jake, what are you going to do, buddy?
I have never pranked the Jake
sheep.
Paulers before, yo. I prank everyone. I prank Erica. I prank Nick with the tasers.
Oh, my God.
First of all, the Jake Paulers are lit.
Correct.
But they've never been pranked
thing
before,
about
guys.
This. We're watching them in the office, and it's like... They're actually fairly professionally produced.
They put a lot of energy and effort into the production value.
Well, no, I mean, they've got multiple camera people. They've got decent
no, these are good cameras.
They've
editing,
got some
fast
good
editing.
Shots.
Yeah.
You know, they obviously know what they're doing. It's just that what they're doing is complete bollocks.
Yeah, they're trying. Well, they're using high quality and professional camera equipment to pretend like they're shooting with smartphones.
Exactly.
Right.
And,
right.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a good point. The aesthetic is smartphone, isn't it?
But it's all. Stem from the, when I go back to this, this is all gamer culture. This whole the entire approach, the entire point of view, this is stems from gamer culture is the root.
Does your husband act like this, Serenity?
No, God, no. Well, this is the thing though. Gamer culture and people who game, I feel like, are two entirely separate camps that occasionally overwhelm.
Well, one thing, like, I know about gaming is there's many, many, many verticals, right? I play games. I can't wait to play Unknown Battlegrounds comes out for my Xbox a couple of weeks. But that doesn't put, I'm not in the gamer culture, obviously. I mean, there's many verticals. There's console gamers, there's PC gamers, there's set the mattress on fire gamers. I don't know. I sound like an old guy.
It's the difference between, like, if we want to bring this over to the tech sphere, it's the difference between, like, your casual tech enthusiast who really enjoys tech and, like, the Android fanboys with an eye who are like, oh, my God, stuff, you know? And it's and that's every single company. I don't want to pick on
no,
Android.
No, in fact, we celebrate those guys. Those are our fans.
Yeah, yeah. They are. But like there can be a dark side to any kind of fandom. There can be a dark side to Android, there can be a dark side to toy fandom, there can certainly be a dark side to gaming fandom. And I think the thing to remember is like we need to not celebrate the dark side.
Right.
We need to promote the good, like, you know, like Felicia Day's gaming culture is a much better representation of, hey, look, here are gamers who actually enjoy, you know, sunlight and friends and not just being on other people.
I don't really have a problem with it. I mean, I don't understand the aesthetic of it, but I don't have, I mean, that's fine. If people do, that's fine. Here's the only thing that I see as a little bit of a negative is Google is happy to have these numbers come out and do this list. They do their own list. They're really happy to make these guys celebrities because for these 10 people, there are 100,000 young kids
who are earning
nothing, who are busting their ass, who are building YouTube's platform for YouTube and making money for YouTube, but making very little money themselves. And it's kind of like the NBA. They're kind of looking at these $16 million people saying, I want to be that guy. And they're not obviously going to make that. Some of them might. There is some turnover in this list. There's a lot.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, the NBA analogy is very good, you know. Hundreds of thousands of kids play football in school, and then the best of those go on and they try out. They go to college and they try and withdraw. And a very, very small number make massive bucks.
There's no farm team for YouTube, though. You just do it.
Yeah.
You are in the bigs minute you post.
These brothers originally got popular on YouTube because they had a big Vine following.
Right.
And they transmitted the Vine following into YouTube, and they monetized it that way. You know, these are not people just making this up. I mean, they've worked at it, and this is why you can't begrudge them the money they're making.
I absolutely don't.
Only thing I do begrudge them is the stuff that they're making. When you've got this platform, maybe try and be a bit smarter about
it. It doesn't say much about them. It says much more about the audience.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
That's what more worries me. If they're catering to an audience and the audience loves them, they're making $16.5 million a year, more power to them. But it does tell you something about the audience or not.
True. Well, and then you've got the whole other segment here with the stuff that's going on with Patreon
About Patreon, because this did not get a lot of coverage, except that everybody who's on Patreon or knows somebody on Patreon was very upset about this. What happened?
Oh, gosh. Well, in a nutshell, Patreon decided that they were going to change their subscription terms. So essentially, they had a problem in that when you sign up to support, say, I decide to support my friend who does comics and I sign up on the 15th of the month, I'm not actually going to get charged for my pledge to them. Say I want to pay them $10 a month or $10 a creation. I don't get charged for that until the end of the month. So Patreon was getting ire from both creators and and backers supposedly saying, hey, why do I get charged 3 weeks later for this thing that I forgot I pledged to? And creators are like, oh, these people, signed up to get my stuff and then vanished before the thing could get charged. And so their argument is, oh, well, instead of, charging everybody at the end of the month, we're going to charge you when you sign up. But that means we have to switch our payment plans around. So it means that we're going to have to charge individual processing fees. So we're changing our processing fee structure. So now instead of creators paying the percentage of credit card processing fees when they get the pledges, instead the backers are going to be paying those processing fees. And in addition to a percentage, like I think it's 2.2% or something like that, you're also getting a flat 35-cent fee. So, for instance, if you pledge $1 to somebody, it's now going to be $1.40 from your checking account every month.
So the biggest change is that you as the donor are paying now instead of the creator. The creator is going to get more money, right?
In theory. The problem with this, obviously, is that donors are obviously upset. And creators are upset because Patreon is not letting them make the call, right? If Patreon said, okay, well, we're going to let you choose whether as a creator you take the hit of the percentage fee or you make your backers take the hit, and that got some people upset that there's no choice. But I think the real issue and the issue that I think a lot of Patreon creators have kind of rallied around is that their initial messaging around this was very vague and very frustrating. And even their clarification as to why they decided to make that change. As I explained to you, it sounds in theory like you're trying to fix a good problem, but you get that in coupled with a recent blog post, basically a guest blog post that was made from their head of growth marketing that essentially said, hey, you know, Patreon's really great, but what we really want to do is move our business structure more to the people who make their living off Patreon and focus less on the people who only make, you know, $200-$300 a month off of our service. And when you couple that philosophy with the fact that Patreon has recently taken quite a lot of VC money, including another round of, I think, $35 million in September, the picture starts to get a whole lot more cloudy. And there starts to be the question of, like, what is Patreon actually doing here? Are they actually trying to, in making this move, push people away from $1 pledges to try and get the people who are on their service to be supported, you know, in bigger and bigger dollar amounts so that they can get more profit? Or is this just a issue of terrible messaging on their part?
So Hank Green posted, and his partner Jeff Jacks on their Vlogbrothers podcast posted, for instance, on Twitter, all these people leaving because of the change in fees. They're dropping their contributions. Can we confirm that? Are people losing donors,
yes,
patrons in droves? So that's one concern, is that there are a lot of people rely on Patreon.
Absolutely. I have a friend, Mikey Newman, who runs a really amazing video show called Movies with Mikey, which, by the way, if you love film criticism, you should watch it. But I think he's lost something like 95 patrons in the last, I don't know, in the last 7 days, basically 8 days. And this is a guy who, you know, he's pretty great. He wrote the scripts for Borderlands and, like, but he has a personal stuff that required him to make this his full-time job. And for him to, you know, to basically his entire livelihood be risked on a fee change, when, you know, you already have so much in your life that's up, you know, thrown into upheaval. I don't think that Patreon really thought this through from a perspective of, like, the whole point of your platform is that you're giving people who might not otherwise have a way to monetize their art, a way to monetize their art. And that doesn't always mean people who are making, you know, $3,000, $5,000, $10,000 a month off of a project. It's the people who are making just enough to cover their utilities or even a whole lot more. Like, that's who really needs Patreon. That's who really benefits from them. And by basically saying the $1 pledges, you know, they're not really worth it to us, it sets a really bad precedent for what they want their company to be.
So they
need to get on top of this.
There are competitors, but, I mean, for instance, Kickstarter just launched Drip, which is exactly what Patreon does. But that doesn't solve the problem, because if you have a bunch of patrons on Patreon and you're doing, and you've been basing your business for a year or two on this, and all of a sudden your revenue's cut in half, it's not like you could say, "Hey, everybody, follow me over to Drip." Maybe you can.
I think you could. I mean, there's a guy in Australia I follow who does a YouTube channel called Primitive Technology, where he, you know, recreates, you know, how to make a you know, pottery stuff, and he's working his way up to the Bronze Age at the moment. He gets a lot of money from Patreon, and they're fascinating videos and with no sound whatsoever. But he's seen a massive drop off in Patreon funds. Now, if he was to say to his supporters, okay, why don't we go to this new platform? And if a lot of the big Patreon players turn around and say, yeah, we need to shift to this new platform and this is why, and explain it to people, I think Patreon could be cutting their own throat just in favor of short-term profit.
I kind of blame the patrons, though. I feel like the patrons, I think this was, all right, I don't, this will be controversial. I always thought this was a little bit of a problem with Patreon, is that it's easy to contribute, and it's also easy to stop contributing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a thin thread that holds people there. And all it took was this nudge, 35-cent nudge from Patreon, and if people are going, screw it. And I think that really reflects more a problem with just the relationship between creators and patrons. I blame the patrons. No?
My concern here is that there's more, it's much more nuanced, right? Where it's, I don't think it's just, oh, it's an extra 35 cents. Well, now I'm not doing it. It's the trust is gone, right?
Well, that's where the point is that the patrons are more pissed off at Patreon than they're supporting the creator. And their pissed offness is saying, well, screw it, I quit. Even
well, it's not
though
even
it damages
that.
Your it damages the person you're supporting.
It's not it, well in a way, yes, but also you have to consider that the people who are giving these kinds of pledges to Patreon users, like say you're signed up at the $1 or $5 level to promote something, like to give money to somebody. You could just be buying their merch, right? Buying their t-shirts or their books or whatever they're selling. But maybe you don't, maybe you're a college kid, right? Maybe you don't actually have the financial means to do that. And when Patreon rejiggers their fee structure and plays around like this, what Patreon is essentially saying is, hey, you who only has a dollar a month to support, maybe you support, you know, 10, 15 creators at a dollar a month. Now, all of a sudden, your budget to support those creators, because everything's essentially, you know, gone up almost double in price. Okay, now instead of supporting 15 people, I can only support like 6 or 7. So I have to make that call. Who am I going to take away? And it's not that you don't value those creators. It's that physically you just, you have to now decide who do I value most? Because now that decision has been taken out of your hands.
So it's an economic decision? I feel like it's more of a typical internet tantrum.
No, I think oh, sorry.
No. I assume you're probably going to say the same, where it's a combination. Mm.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think also Patreon, they've got this VC funding. They're actually profitable. I think they make something like $8 million a year.
Yeah, not a huge amount.
No, not a huge amount, and certainly not enough to justify the valuation that's been put on the company. And I think this is what comes back to Sorrenti was saying. What they're hoping this will do is mean that, you know, all the sort of the $1 and the $2 bit payers that don't really make them that much money, they can just go away. We'll focus on the really big players and we'll get our valuation from then. And you're just like, yeah, that might work to get you to an IPO, but it kills the platform. You know, all it's going to take is somebody with enough of a following together, and they can take Patreon down.
I know Jack Connie. We've had him on a few times. We've had Pamplemousse on a few times, the founder of Patreon. Who was a creator, was an artist, and made music and couldn't make a living and created Patreon because he saw an opening. I think he has genuinely a good heart here and is trying to do the right thing. But this is what happens when you do a deal with the devil, when you do a deal with venture capital. The pressure changes. You lose control of what you can do. And I guarantee you, when you have a $400 million valuation on an $8 million net, there's pressure from the VCs. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We got to turn that around. Well, this is not a return on our investment. And so I suspect that's the problem. I don't necessarily blame Patreon. I blame their investors who are probably putting a huge amount of pressure on Patreon.
Well, I think people are panicking in the sphere now. We saw this with Mashable being sold for a quarter of what it was worth. Yeah. Same with Shazam. Same with a lot of these companies that have built very nice little niches but aren't that profitable. And are now having to accept the reality that they're not worth as much money as their investors thought they were.
Yeah, but who in the world would value Shazam at $400 million? I mean, really? Come on. Shazam is the program. By the way, there's plenty of competition, including...
Oh, Google give it away
Pixel
for free.
Pixel 2 XL does it automatically.
Yeah, exactly.
And so they raised $400 million. No, I'm sorry.
No, they raised money to a valuation But that money is now largely gone.
Actually, you know, their last funding valued the company at $1 billion for telling people what the song was. So apparently Apple's getting a good deal.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying, when the Mashable deal was announced, I actually went back and found an article from 2012 on why Mashable is easily worth $200 million. And it was just like...
Sold for 50 in a fire sale. And somebody's saying, well, you got to blame Jack for taking VC. No, you can't. I think it's a very easy thing to do as a founder to say, we need money. Look at somebody's throwing a lot of money at us. Let's take it and not understand the deal you're doing and the risks you're taking. It's been a hard thing for me. Not that anybody's been throwing money at me, but I want control. I don't want to lose control.
Well,
was the highest value for me, so that's the thing I wasn't.
I mean, a lot of VCs threw money into these things, and these companies responded by buying up large numbers of staff and getting fancy headquarters when there was no real business
right
case behind it. And if you build it, they will come, and that doesn't work.
Nope. Let's take a break. We'll come back with more. We had a fun week this week, lots of fun. And actually, I want to talk about Windows on ARM because we did that with Mary Jo. We're going to talk about the Snapdragon 845. Here's a little sampler, a Whitman sampler, if you will, of things you might have missed if you missed anything this week on Twit.
Previously on Twit.
You can't buy an Apple TV on Amazon either. If you search for Apple TV on Amazon, it's great. You get like, you know, a $12 plastic device. There it is.
Yeah,
the total mount Apple TV mounts here. Yeah, we'd like to mount you.
They have a right.
Yeah, I said that.
It's a new business model.
The new screensavers.
How you develop the perfect laptop. What if you went to 1,000 users and asked them?
One is that you get a hot mess that no one can actually use. The other is that you get something awesome that everybody enjoys.
It could be one or the other. We've got the Eve V computer.
Windows Weekly.
Paul Thurrott, he is in Maui.
Qualcomm is having their Snapdragon Tech Summit here this year. The big news today was the 845, which is obviously the next generation mobile processor.
But I think they got scooped just a little teeny weeny bit by Microsoft,
which announced
that finally WOA is here, Windows on ARM.
Security Now.
Last week, this horrific flaw in Mac OS, High Sierra, came out. There was a function which said, I successfully determined whether you entered the proper password. But separately, there was whether or not you entered the proper password that the code wasn't checking.
Success can mean different things to different people.
That's the
moral of the story.
Twit. It keeps going and going and going.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's kind of humiliating.
I don't know. It's really no worse than anything else we've done on
this
show.
It's kind of fun when you get everybody in there.
Care to explain?
that's good. Nothing to say about that.
I don't think you should just leave it there.
Put it back in the oven. And that was, yes, Patrick Norton back on the new screensavers. We had a lot of fun on Saturday. Do watch that episode if you're fans of the old screensavers. It's very much like the good old days. And as somebody said in the chat room, Patrick has gone full lumberjack. His beard and plaid and
unrecognizable almost.
Really? No, I like the look. Yeah. I really do. I think he's great. Yeah. It's so much fun. It's always fun to go back and work with people you've known for decades.
Mm.
Decades. Wow. Our show today brought to you by Capterra. If you're, working and the boss comes to you and says, and it's always like Friday before the week before Christmas, right? It's going to happen. And says, Smithers, we need new software to run this business. It's your job to find it. I'll come back to me Monday and have it. And you go, what do you go to Google and search? No, you go to Capterra, and you get home on time. You don't miss your TV show tonight. Whether you're looking to keep track of customers or a nonprofit hoping to have a record fundraising year, maybe you're a yoga studio or a bakery, or on and on and on, 500 categories of business software. This is the best directory ever, not just because it's got every piece of software. It's got 260,000 real reviews and ratings from real users just like you, and it's free. Did I mention it's free? It's free! So you go to Capterra.com, search for the category you need, check the box that says, it has to do this, it has to do that, it's got to run on Windows, it's got to run on the net, whatever it is, and you can narrow it right down. You won't waste time on, Googling stuff and finding, paid shill reviews. You won't waste your time on free trials that go nowhere. Capterra's got everything you need to get your job done. Just look at all the categories. I mean, it goes on. There's accounting software, and so including FreshBooks, one of our sponsors. 2018 is on the way, and so is the boss. I hear him now coming down the hall. Smithers, I've got a job for you, Smithers. You don't need to celebrate Christmas. So make sure you got the software your business needs today to help you do what you do better. Join the millions who use Capterra free. Did I say free? Free. Capterra, Capterra, Capterra.com/twit to find the software that will save your business time. Capterra.com/twit. We thank him so much for the support of This Week in Tech. Serenity Caldwell from iMore.com. The Grillmaster from Tech Burger, Dwight Silverman. So nice to see you again.
It's so good to be here, Leo.
Yeah, you like talking about it. See, tech is a great subject to wax on about because it's not really important, except that it is.
It is.
But nobody really dies. It's not like hovering
sometimes
helicopter
they do.
Crashes. Well, I suppose, yeah.
It is the single biggest change agent in our society.
And I would submit it's never boring because it's always something new, which is kind of fun. Also from the register.co.uk, our favorite Brit, Mr. Ian Thompson. Top 10 YouTube videos of the year. Who could forget?
Oh, that kid
was great. The BBC presenter whose kid came up. I love this still. And, of course, his wife then crawls in, pulls the kid out. Let's see. What are the top videos? They're, of the top 10 videos, 633 million views, 40 million hours total. These are the top trending videos as of this week, according to The Verge.
Oh, good grief.
I don't know. A lot of it's music. Until We Become Dust by Oyster Masked. I think that's, I don't know. What is that? Is that an American? This looks like maybe Bollywood. What kind of, what is this? This is some, I don't recognize this. This is the K-pop, number.
Maybe.
186,986,685 views. Just music. It's music. It's nice. It's nice music. If I play any more, we will be, oh, look, she's wearing a mask. Ooh, I don't know. I don't know what's going on. Okay, that's one. Let's see number two here. Number two is also a song. I don't have to play it. It's Ed Sheeran. You know Ed Sheeran. Number three, Dude Perfect.
Ping pong trick ping shots.
But this, you would watch this over and over again. You'd wonder, how does he do it? How does he do it? Sponsored by Oreo. There are Oreos.
I wonder why.
There are Oreos involved. Look at this. Wow. Okay, I'd watch this. This is like OK Go, right? Ping pong tricks. And the thing is, I'm surprised this guy's not, if this guy's not making big money, he's got 95 million views and it's Oreo sponsored, right?
Yeah, should be.
Number three video on YouTube, okay?
I still think my favorite like that for the week was the Thomas the Tank Engine stunt video, which if you haven't seen it, highly recommend.
I haven't.
Oh, no, Thomas the Tank Engine doing stunts. Trust me, it's worth a shot.
America's Got Talent.
I'm putting that on mine.
12-year-old singing ventriloquist gets the golden buzzer. Now, I don't even know what the golden buzzer is. Is that good or bad?
I've never watched the show, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't. You don't have to watch a show.
No, it's just it's having to watch Simon Cowell because he's got a. There's the Germans have a face for it. It's a phrase for it. It's he has a face exquisitely made for punching.
it does beg to be socked, doesn't it? Yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Very good.
So this is a 12-year-old ventriloquist, number four, 42 million views.
Why did you both decide to enter the show?
Well, there's it was
Simon.
One of my big
God,
dreams.
I think people need a good kidney, and he's still got two functional
ones. Oh! More Ed Sheeran. Number five, Carpool Karaoke. Lady Gaga's Super Bowl halftime show, which I even admit I've watched on YouTube a couple of times because it was amazing. How did she do that? Except when you realize that they taped much of it ahead of time. It kind of took the fun out of it. Bad lip reading of the Donald Trump inauguration speech. I could watch bad lip reading.
Yeah.
All day. 32 million views. This is number eight on the list.
It's not so important. I should
have. Oh, surprise. I have some pretzels for you.
Oh, you're cheery.
Me? I'm always like this.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You're certainly not going to be.
When can I see
you're
you
bad
walk
company.
Away? Can't wait.
Oh, I love
it's
those bad lip readings.
A good one.
Here's a number eight. I'm sorry, that was number seven. History of the Entire World. It's 19 minutes, 35 million views.
Hi, you're on a rock floating in space. Pretty cool, huh?
Bill
Some
Wirtz.
Of it's water. Actually, most of it's water.
Okay.
Whoa.
It's all right. You know, it's YouTube.
It's sad.
What do you expect?
I'm sad.
The kids watch this. They learn vocabulary.
A long time ago. Actually, never. And also now. Nothing is nowhere. When? Never. Makes sense, right? Like I said, it didn't happen. Nothing was never anywhere. That's why it's been everywhere.
Wow, that's very Dada. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried CPG Grey?
I love CPG Grey.
Yeah, fantastic.
He is brilliant. His stuff makes sense.
Yeah.
This is In
this
a Heartbeat.
This is really cute.
This is a short, animated short, 4-minute short. A closeted boy runs the risk of being outed by his own heart after it pops out of his chest to chase show more. Oh, no. To chase down the boy of his dreams. Well, that's cute. You know what? This is quality.
Really
this is a quality animated short.
I'd forgotten about this until it just showed up on this list.
This is kind of an antidote to the other list, the top 10 earners.
Yeah.
The top 10 viewed, many of these are really good.
Yeah.
And you could see grown-up people watching them and enjoying them. This is quite cute.
It's good animation as well.
YouTube is a boon for short filmmakers, right?
Yeah, this is a college short, final presentation,
wow,
which is really amazing.
What a boon. I mean, before, you'd make this, there'd be no way to see it. Maybe if you were lucky, you'd get in an anthology going to movie theaters and college towns and so forth. But now, thanks to YouTube, 32 million people have seen this video. That's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's a couple of college filmmakers, Beth David and Esteban Bravo.
I hope they have amazing jobs right now.
Well, yeah, boy, if they don't, then somebody's missing the boat.
But it is nice how you can actually get to see this, because, I mean, for years, I heard rumor of a film called Bambi Meets Godzilla.
Yeah.
I'd never actually seen it.
Right.
And then it wasn't until the internet came around that you could actually see it and see what the fuss was about and go, this is brilliant.
Yep. Here is the number 10, but in my mind, this will always be number one in my heart. Children Interrupt. BBC News. It hasn't lost any of its charm, has it? I mean,
shifting. You see,
he shoves the kid back. Tries to maintain his
calm. That hurts me.
And then a little kid comes in the walker. Now mom comes in. By the way, mom's pants are halfway down, so she was obviously in the bathroom. And she's sneaking out, hoping that she's not on camera. Pulling the children. I still get a kick. This is why YouTube works. And then the hand. This is what makes YouTube great, because that.
I'd have had a lot more respect if he'd actually picked up the kid and just put him on his knee and carried on the interview.
The pushing away is what bothers me. Everything else is cute.
But we've seen interviews with him since. And, you know, I mean, we actually dissected this when it happened. He was in the bedroom on a Skype call with the BBC.
Oh,
he's even, in fact, if you look at it, he's carefully staged his bedroom. He's put some books on the
world
bed
map
there. He's got a world map behind him just to make it feel a little bit like it's, you know, like something kind of professional. He's probably not wearing pants, but my suspicion is the reason he doesn't get up and get the kid is there's nothing below the tie. I mean, he's probably, he was wearing shorts. He went called by the BBC from dinner.
I've been there, so yeah.
Sure. And it's the Beeb, right?
No, I mean, I did an interview with the BBC World Service at DEF CON this year.
Yeah.
And because we were doing it over Skype, we had to get the hotel room as quiet as possible. So I had to turn the air conditioning off. But because it was on radio, it didn't really matter that way. And so I did the entire interview in my pants. And the temptation at the end of it to say, this has been Ian Thompson in his pants in Las Vegas.
By the way, for those of you who are not British, you have to explain, in his pants doesn't mean in his trousers.
Oh, yes, sorry.
It means not with trousers, merely in his underpants.
Just in my underwear. In freedom speech, we're just in my underwear, yes.
Is that what we call it now, freedom speech? Is American, is freedom speech? Let's see. What do you think, since we were talking about Facebook has launched a new messaging platform for kids.
They've got to get them somehow.
I'm rolling my eyes at that.
It's Facebook's version of Joe Camel and candy cigarettes.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. It's for 6 to 12-year-olds, people too young to be on Facebook because of the Child Online Protection and Privacy Act. It's very colorful. And the idea is parents will... Oh, look how happy the music is. We'll approve.
As a mom, I know how
to... And Sheryl Sandberg, who is a mom, COO of Facebook.
It must be good, right?
She's a mom. As a mom. And so the idea is that you approve. They can only message with people you approve, obviously friends and family, nobody else. Let's get those kids messaging. I think we should. Now, I have mixed feelings about that because kids do want a message.
They do. But
and it's a skill that's useful.
You read the announcement about this? It was one of the creepiest things you can imagine, because they were saying, we're not going to sell adverts to these kids. And, you know, you get a strict control over who they speak to. But we are going to share the information on their viewing habits within the Facebook family.
Including advertisers, right?
Yeah. So it's kind of like one of those really creepy, twisted families where everyone spies on everyone else.
Now, Facebook says there are no ads on Messenger Kids.
Mm-hmm.
We will not use data for advertising. The provision about sharing information with vendors from the privacy policies for things like providing infrastructure to deliver messages, CDNs, and things like that. On the other hand, Facebook's known for, you know, doing stuff first and then asking, you know, apologizing later.
Yeah.
Well, just because they're not showing it to the kids doesn't mean they're not showing things to their parents based on what the kids are saying.
Well, that's the bigger issue.
Also true.
You're getting somebody, what you want to do is get somebody in the Facebook meat grinder as early as possible, because the more data points you can get about that person, by the time they are 13 and you can show them ads,
you know a lot.
You know everything.
I think Dwight was spot on this. It's Joe Camel all over again. I mean, it's just like, get them while they're young. Facebook isn't attracting the young people anymore, so let's just get an in.
How can we subvert a law passed in the 1990s to keep kids off of the internet?
Kids want to be on the internet, though, and don't they need to become internet natives? This is they're going to grow up in the world. They're going to be using all these tools. Is it just too early to do that, or is Facebook not the right steward of the data that they're going to get?
There are already kids on Facebook under 13. They go on as pseudonyms. They put in the, it's not hard to do. And, essentially, if you're a parent, you can say to your kid, well, do this and maybe you won't, get illicitly on full Facebook. But, kids are just going to be on both of them.
Yeah.
Lisa signed up our 14-year-old or 15-year-old now. He just had his birthday with Facebook when he was born, so that she would have his name and let him in a Well, that makes sense. I mean, I signed up for I got my kids' .com addresses when they were born, right? I mean, but at the same time, she didn't let Michael use it until he was a little bit older. And I think the best thing to do would be to, if you're going to do it, train them in how to protect themselves and protect their privacy. Use it as a teaching tool so that they understand what Facebook can do with the information and why you don't want to give them too much information. I don't know. I'm torn, because these kids are going to grow up in this world. You can't keep them offline and hope that everything's going to work out.
And I don't think I'm against kids being on the internet, because God knows I was in messaging boards from the age of 9 or 8 or 9. That's okay. But you make a really good point in that the security concerns have vastly changed. You know, when I was growing up, the internet concerns were, okay, just don't give too much of information about yourself, because you don't want to get fished by a 36-year-old man looking to meet 13-year-old girls on the internet.
Yeah.
Now it's a lot more nefarious. Now it's you don't have to worry about other people. You also have to worry about the companies. And you also have to worry about, specific data points that you're giving out. And if you're making up a fake, a fake personality, as many people often do when they're first going on the internet, be careful that doesn't come back to bite you either. Like there's so much navigational straits that the kids have to go through these days that I don't know. I feel like, why add another layer of complication to it? Let's make this nice and friendly for children. No, you know what? Honestly, if you want to set your kids up with a group that they can talk to, if you want, their friends or something like that, it makes much more sense to set them up with like a Signal group or Slack or something.
Hip parent sets them up. I don't want to set you up with Signal.
Oh, true no, encryption. You know what I mean, though.
No, that's great. I'm agreeing with you. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
Don't set them up with Facebook. Yeah. Set them up with Signal. I think kids need to learn that you're right. The platform is now not the enemy, but the platform is the thing to be cautious about. But I don't think most adults in America really understand the risks and the hazards of Facebook in the way that we do, obviously.
You see this time and again with politicians getting elected for the first time. This has just been an issue in the UK. People then go through their social media feeds from the last few years, find something they've said which has been either objectionable or just downright stupid, and this comes back to haunt people.
I'm glad my kids are grown.
Well, I'm just glad I grew up in an age without digital photography, but I mean, it's just...
I'm just glad that I used the internet before all of my friends and enemies were on the internet. I can't imagine going through high school with everybody in high school also on the internet and treating it as their personal domain.
Twitter weaponizes bullying.
Yeah. Right. All of them do. Right.
Yeah, any social network does, but I mean,
Twitter's the worst, though.
Twitter's a cesspit of villainy and scum. But, you know, it's just...
Exactly. All right, well, what about this? Do you have a voice assistant? Do you have an Echo or a Google Home in the house if you have kids?
Nope.
Do you let them talk to it?
I don't have one in the house. I don't have kids.
I love my Google Home and my Echo and all that stuff. I feel like they're very useful. Here's a poll Chaim Gartenberg did on Twitter. Do you say please or thank you when you talk to Echo or assistant? 45% no, it's just a robot. 32% sometimes. 23% say yes.
Spotted the Brits. I always say please to my Google assistant.
Do you say please to your Echo and your assistant?
Well, it's my Google assistant, yes. It's just politeness. You know, it costs nothing.
I think it's important. Here's my... We talked about this a little bit, but my thought is you should teach kids that the difference between a machine and a human, and not... Very important not to anthropomorphize talking machines.
Mm.
Not to... I mean, this is, an opportunity to say, now you understand that's just a machine. Even though it has a human voice, it's just a machine.
You remember when sex education was the worst thing you had to talk to your kids about?
My God.
Now you've got to do
that's nothing.
Internet education
now
as well.
Now it's just a YouTube account, say, learn about sex, but let's talk later about privacy.
So have you seen that UK series called Humans?
No, I hear it's very... Oh, that's the one with the robots, the humanoid robots?
Yes.
I love that series. Oh, you haven't seen
and
it?
And what's
no,
interesting
I haven't
is
seen it.
It's so good. Oh, it's really good. It's in it's from the UK. It is I think there's two or three seasons of it. And essentially they call them synths, and they look like humans, except they have these glowing eyes, and somebody uploads into all the synths a program that gives them consciousness.
Ooh.
And they essentially begin to say, we don't want to be treated like this, because people treat them like machines, even though they're not. And it is it's a pretty interesting and very, I think, prescient series. If you haven't seen it, it's definitely worth catching.
Oh, that goes on my playlist. That's excellent. Yeah. Thank
what
you.
What was the British – I was trying to remember. The last time you were here, there was a show you said you have to watch, British
Spaced.
Comedy. Spaced. Thank
yeah.
you. I'm making a list. Although The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon is fabulous. Period piece, 1957. Isn't it great? I figured you'd like it. It's right up your alley. I just had that feeling.
Amy Sherman Palladino. How can you not like anything?
She's Gossip
Girl,
right?
Yeah.
She's,
no, she did Gilmore Girls.
Gilmore Girls. No. That's not quite not.
Is this a show that Amazon is spooling out one episode at a time?
No.
As opposed
no.
to they have dumped it all. There's some show where one of them is like doing it episodically, like traditional television. I forget which one it is.
That seems
but
like that, a
that's
bad
really
idea.
Interesting.
Yeah. No.
Yeah, particularly for that.
We got The Crown to watch. We've got I've got now mm-hmm. Space to watch. But if you get a chance, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, because it's 1958. New York, beautifully rendered, great music, and a very strong female lead that is so good, so much fun. And Kevin Pollak is fabulous in it, so is Tony Shalhoub. Really good cast.
I've just had The Norseman recommended to me, and I watched a couple of episodes, which seem quite... It's Viking...
Yeah,
it's set in the Viking.
It seems like we get a lot of mileage out of the Vikings.
It's kind of like a comedy thing, though, because one of the guys punches a slave and goes, "You know, John, I'm not sure about this force-based management system that you introduced."
All right, I'm watching it. That's it. I'm watching
good
it.
Time.
The you Office meets Vikings.
Yeah, you know my favorite guilty pleasure show, and this is a weird one out of left field, but I've really enjoyed Riverdale. I don't know if anybody's actually watched. It's Archie Comics meets Twin Peaks. It's really Ooh. Weird and really, like, it shouldn't be good. It is a CW show that by all rights and means should be terrible, yet the costume design and the writing is excellent.
It's literally Archie
it's
and his gang. It's
yes,
literally
it's
Archie.
It's literally Archie
right?
Comics.
Sinister.
But a sinister, it's like Smallville or something. It's like a reinvented.
No. I mean, it is reinvented, but it's more, it's definitely, it's Archie Comics and a mystery show.
Oh, I'm watching this for sure.
It's really, it's like, it's guilty pleasure TV, but it knows what it is.
It's got Veronica and Betty. Jughead's in it. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah.
I'll be watching this.
It's excellent.
There's too much good TV. That's the real problem. Let's take a break. I do want to talk about Windows on ARM. Go ahead. You get one too.
One more. So there's this show on Netflix called Dark.
That is so freaking dark.
It's very German. It's the German Stranger Things.
It's the only way to describe
it. It's like Black Mirror, but done American style.
No, it's Stranger Things. It's very similar to Stranger Things. Okay. But it's all in German.
It's Stranger Things without any humor, which is very German. And it's very despairing.
The only thing I don't like about it is that its dubbing is terrible.
Well, don't watch the dubbing. Watch the...
They have a version that's subtitled. Yes. God, the dubbing is so... You feel like you're watching a comedy.
Never, ever.
Oh, dubbing is terrible. Oh, I didn't know they have different versions. Okay.
Yes. Watch the one with the... Because in German, it's even more intense.
Oh, you can imagine. I mean, Germany is very sort of dark.
Do you have audio on this? Let's hear the audio.
Germany is such a dark and brutal language. It's why you never get great German love poets. It's just slow.
Oh, yes, Wim Wenders, dark. Yeah. It's very Stranger Things.
Yeah.
But it's the first Netflix original produced in outside the U.S., right?
We're going to see a lot more of these. They're getting really into the production game. And they're doing
very well. They're spending $8 billion this year. And that's just a fraction of what they plan to spend next year.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
You know, they could pay their taxes as well, but hey, you know.
I have to watch it over again in German because it was terrible. And if you want a comedy, watch the dub version. The acting is so bad. It's horrible. Our show today brought to you by Texture. I love magazines. Who doesn't love magazines? I got to tell you, though, with the cost and the clutter of buying magazines, even if you subscribe, then there's the guilt factor. I got a pile of New Yorkers I never read. And I feel like I can't read the new New Yorker till I've read all the old New Yorkers. That's why I got Texture. And now I love it. It's the app the iPad was invented for. Works on iPad, Android, iOS. It is more than 200 magazines, all the best magazines in the country, for less than 10 bucks a month, flat fee. It's Netflix for magazines. And you not only got every page of the current newsstand issue, but back issues, bonus features that you don't get in a magazine like video, photography magazines like Shutterbug and National Geographic look so much better because you're instead of seeing a bad print of the photo, you're seeing it on your screen and it looks gorgeous. The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, Wired. I get all my gossip from Us and Entertainment Weekly and People. They're all there. If you're looking for vacation time, if Afar and Airbnb magazine, if you like to cook Bon Appetit and Real Simple, I can go on and on. The Atlantic Time, if you like politics, it's all in there. Texture. And to start your free Texture trial, free Texture trial, go to texture.com/twit. And we have a very special deal because normally, if you want it, I think it's $12, $13 a month. But if you go to texture.com/twit, and decide to subscribe, you'll get it for just $9.99 a month, 30% off the listed price. And what a great gift for family and friends. This is the future of magazines, in my opinion. All the best magazines, flat rate, right there in your iPad or your iPhone or your Android device. Go to texture.com/twit to start your free trial today. We thank Texture for their support. Whenever I travel, I have Texture with me. Windows on ARM. Qualcomm had a big event in Maui. Paul Thurrock got to go. Ryan Schrout got to go. Lots of people we know got to go. We didn't get to go. They announced the Snapdragon 845, but interestingly, that was scooped by the Snapdragon 835-based Windows devices with, quote, all-day power. If I were Intel, I'd be freaking out right about now. This is not Intel's year. First, they lose mobile, right? Qualcomm and the ARM family just destroy them on mobile. Apple uses ARM architecture license, but they make their own chips essentially like ARM chips. Qualcomm's and everything else. But at least Intel still had the desktop and they still had the network center. ARM is in the network center now. Because its power curve is good. I mean, you don't use a lot of energy, and they seem to do a decent job. You're right; Intel probably still owns the premium.
But yes, this fundamentally attacks the Intel alliance, which has gone on with Windows pretty much since the start. The big question here is, can they make it work? Because our guy was trying these new laptops out in Maui, and he was saying you're looking at double the lag time.
That's not good.
If he was typing fast, the words were appearing after he typed them.
Can't keep up.
That's because it has to use emulation on certain apps. Now, they're going to port Office, you know, Microsoft Office to ARM, so you hopefully get rid of the emulation lag there. But, you know,
it's really, in fact, the new devices which will come from Lenovo and Acer and others start with Windows 10S, which is the version of Windows that is low power and only runs apps, UWP apps from the Windows Store. And those probably, I would guess, run at full speed. They're designed to run on ARM. Yeah. They're compiled for ARM. But if you get, if you said, I want to upgrade it to Windows 10 Pro and I want to put Chrome on it, Chrome would not run well.
No, you've got to run it through an emulator, which can add, but the estimates they saw was basically, it doesn't quite double the speeds, but it nearly doubles them. And that's really, really worrying. But I think the Windows 10S is key on this one, because I think they're clearly aiming this at student markets. But I just looking at the prices of some of these
things.
They're
not that low. They're $500 to $700.
Yeah, 800 in some cases. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know what the others feel about this, but that just seems an insane price for what's essentially just like a big battery Windows machine.
Yeah.
They also only run 32-bit. You have to run 32-bit apps in using Windows Pro.
That's the emulation.
There's Windows 10 Pro, right?
Yeah,
that's not ideal.
And not everything will run on it. So, for example, there are some classes of antivirus that won't run at all on it. And it reminds me, remember, Leo, the 95% IBM compatible computers? That reminds me.
Yeah. God, really? That was a thing? Jeez.
Yes.
What
yes.
A terrible. So
They were advertised, they were clones,
mostly
but they were advertised
compatible.
As being mostly compatible, or even they even had percentages.
Well, it's like when Windows came out with the Vista capable sticker. You know, it's like technically capable, this machine is capable of running Vista, but you wouldn't want to try it.
Don't do it, yeah.
Unfortunately, Intel's also having a problem with its management engine. The Intel management engine, which is in almost all Intel chips, not normally designed to hook up to management unless you have a vPro system and you have an Intel network card. And so there are ways to mitigate that. The problem is there are, at last count, 7 CVEs, that's 7 exploits, that could be taken advantage of if an attacker had local access to your system. So it's the point now where Dell, Lenovo, Purism, System 76 are offering PCs with the Intel management engine physically disabled.
Yeah, and you got to pay, with Dell's case, you got to pay, I think it's $23 to actually get it enabled.
It's worth, yeah, don't. I guess if you are an enterprise, that's a use of the management engine is designed for enterprise. But there are some big problems. And we had been talking about this last month, but they're back again. Intel has published a page with a program you can run if you are using a Windows or a Linux machine. You might want to run this program to see if your system is vulnerable.
Because we have enough problems getting people to patch software now, you know, without having
hardware.
To patch the actual hardware. Yeah. I mean, chances of getting most people to do that, pretty much minimal.
There is a remote vulnerability exploit, CVE 2017-5712, with a valid administrative Intel management engine credential. So that means somebody would have still had to hack you at first, but then they could remotely access your system. And Steve Gibson reported this last week on Security Now. The JTAG engine is exposed, which means that you could use the USB port to hack your machine. You just come along, you got a just little USB dongle, plug it in, and you're done. So this gives you full access route and everything. Might want to check with your motherboard manufacturer, see what their plans are. So a bad week for Intel all around. Johnny Ive is back taking control of Apple's design team. I think I have to say, yay! Feels like Apple's.
Did he ever leave?
Yeah, he was doing the campus, and he
was focusing really on the campus.
Yeah. Well, I didn't see a lot of his presence. They had two guys: Alan Dye, vice president of user interface design, and Richard Haworth, vice president of industrial design, running the design for the last 2 years. They just disappeared from. they're non-persons. They've disappeared now from the management page at apple.com. But Johnny Ive, after an inquiry from Bloomberg, has said, yes, I am in control. And and I think a good thing, because iOS 11 had all sorts of problems. Apple has had a lot of security issues, but just mostly on iOS 11, cosmetic and performance issues. And
I think there's also an innovation problem in there that they haven't really come up with a new product in the last 5 years. I mean, yeah, the other was the watch, but that's kind of everyone else was doing it and they were just copying it. But there seems to be a real innovation lack in Apple at the moment in terms of where they're, what they're going to do after the
Tim
iPhone.
Tim is not an innovation guy. You no, wouldn't expect
he's
Tim
an operations
Cook
to see, guy.
No, he's an operations guy. That's
but
fine.
You'd expect Ive
but
to
you need
be,
a guy. But, and yeah. It should be Johnny Ive, right? One would hope.
Yeah. Well, the problem with Johnny Ive is that you need somebody who keeps him in check. Because yes. Johnny has, like, Ive has an amazing stable of ideas and creations. But, you know, he also created a back there, you know, $250 art book that's right. Just pictures.
Yep.
You know, so there's,
You've
there are limits
copy?
And there are levels here.
She
oh, yeah.
Sure
I have
a copy. Does. Look at it.
Not, yeah, it was a gift.
Oh, right.
It's a nice gift. It's a beautiful yeah. book. I've seen it. It's a beautiful
it is,
book.
It is a beautiful book, and you know what? It's very impressive. But if I had to pick the things that I'd like my, you know, break, you know, life-changing technology experts to focus on, it would not be a $250 book as much as I love books. Mm. That said, I don't think that this is as big of a deal as people are making it out to be, because I can't imagine that Johnny let anything slide by without even giving it a peripheral glance. iOS and macOS have serious problems right now, and I'm not going to downplay that at all. But I don't necessarily think that it's Johnny and the design team that's at fault here. I think it's a little bit of a bigger picture issue. That said,
I agree with you. A Johnny Steve yeah. Jobs partnership was made in heaven.
Oh, it absolutely was.
Yeah. But Johnny needs that sounding board, that guy to say no, that guy to say yes, the guy to drive, crack the whip. I don't know yeah. who that is right now.
I mean, Johnny was the guy that gave us the solid gold iWatch, which was yeah. just such a yeah. dumb idea.
Yeah. Yeah. It was there for status. It was there to increase the cachet of the brand. And the brand is now at a point where it doesn't need that status. The ceramic watch is cool, but it's not that, you know, it's not to that extent. But in terms of, and I do have to disagree with you on the watch being, you know, just something everybody else is doing, because speaking as somebody who owns a 38mm watch, which is the only thing that will actually fit on my wrist, like, there is no other company right now that has been able to do what Apple has done in the form factor that Apple's made for women, especially, or for people with small wrists. Like, there is definitely innovation going on here in a level that I think gets downplayed.
And I think you could also throw the AirPods into that. I finally got some AirPods, and that's a pretty cool product.
Yeah. That's the best thing Apple's done in a while.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I stand corrected, yeah. but I just I don't see it myself.
The watch is one of those things that the third series, probably really the fourth generation of the Apple Watch. It took them a while to make this useful, and it's been a gradual evolution.
Do you actually find it's useful? This is what I don't get about smartwatches. Yeah. You've still got to have your phone with you. They make you terribly rude.
Well, actually, with the cellular version, you don't anymore.
Ah, okay.
That's one big difference.
Well, I mean, I do agree with you, Sorrenti. When I got my first smartwatch for testing, I think it was the LG one. My wife referred to it as the woman repeller because it was like
it's huge. It was huge.
It is.
You know,
it's gigantic. An old school, school communicator. Yeah. No, I mean, I think Ian, the point for, you know, what does a smartwatch do really? I think you really need to find how it works for your life. Like, for me, as a health tool, this is, life-changing, especially because of the training that I do for roller derby and everything else. Without it, I wouldn't be able to tailor my workouts nearly as effectively. And then in combination, what Apple's doing for all-purpose health with the heart study app that just came out that they're enrolling people in to check for atrial fibrillation and things like that. The fact that AliveCor just released a band that hooks to the watch that can take an instantaneous EKG.
That will save lives. That AliveCor band is constantly monitoring. And if you if you're going into AFib, which could be a silent killer, will say quickly, put your finger here, get an EKG and send it to your doctor, and people's lives will be saved by that. That is massive. That is really important.
Yeah.
Well, you saw the story about the man who had was the original Apple Watch. It didn't use the feature where if you're sitting still and your heart races, it suddenly tells you. He had an app doing that, and it happened to him, and he wound up going to the hospital. He had a pulmonary embolism. And the watch probably saved his life. And that story was one of the reasons why I wound up getting an Apple Watch eventually, because I've had pulmonary embolisms.
Yeah, absolutely.
And okay. And the idea that this watch, you know, could alert me to that happening again is very that's one of the reasons I got it.
Serenity, do you use the heart rate, what do they call it, variability interval thing that shows?
Yeah, I do.
So this is I want you to tell me about this. So what it measures is the variability between the beats. Like it should be fairly consistent. And if it's not, is that a problem? Tell me what that means.
No. So interestingly, and this kind of goes against what I think people understand about heart rate variability. It's actually important for your heart rate to be variable.
Oh.
So you actually want it to be at a high variability because that means that your heart can adjust quickly. What that's basically saying is, say that I'm sitting down at rest, right? And then all of a sudden I get up and I jog for 20 seconds. If I have a high heart rate variability, my heart is able to very quickly adjust to that. So it's not going to take, like, my heart's not going to have to go into overdrive to compensate for the fact that it was just sitting. Whereas if you have a low heart rate variability, it means it takes a lot longer for sort of things to get into gear. So it's actually, this is something that's constantly changing. So it's not just like I have a low or a high and then that's it forever. Your heart goes through patterns depending on how hard you're working at any one point and whether or not you regularly work out. So one of the reasons why it's so useful to athletes is you can actually look at it. If you have a high heart rate variability on that day, that actually says you are at peak rest, which means that you can do the most work. And after you've done a hard workout, you can check your heart rate variability at the end of that day. And that'll tell you for the next day, hey, you can still do some work, or your heart rate variability is low. Your body needs to rest and recover, and then you can do another day of hard work the day after that.
See,
there are a lot of really, really interesting studies.
And that's simple. It's just because it's always measuring your heart rate. But I think that's a significant.
Yeah, I mean, it has potential. But again, I don't know. I've just realized I'm the only person on this entire panel not wearing an Apple Watch.
I am not only wearing an Apple Watch, I'm wearing a fitness ring from Motive. This thing has accelerometers, heart rate measures your sleep. It's a sponsor, I should mention. But I'm wearing two. I can get a second opinion if I want.
Yeah, it is interesting, honestly. And in addition to wearing the watch for health features, I do think that this is finally the generation where the software is powerful enough that it's useful. Whereas before, it took too long to load and all of that.
Yeah.
But if you've seen, like, Carrot Weather's most recent app is fantastic if you want mobile weather. There's an app called Smart Gym.
It gives you the weather, but it snarks.
It does.
It snarks.
Ooh, I like the sound.
It does. Yeah. Oh, it's delightful. I should pull up Open Carrot Weather. I should see what it's telling me right now.
Hold it up to the microphone.
I can't read this on the show.
Oh
wait, no. There we go. Currently, no. It just switched back. Originally, it said, it's the perfect time for a wet t-shirt contest earlier today.
Oh, Lord.
And then it updated and went, it's bleeping Mooney. You can fill in the expletive for yourself.
Pick your blah.
But it's delightful. There's an app called Smart Gym that I love that allows you to keep your routines when you go to the gym and not just, you know, start workout, right? It actually shows you, here are your supersets. Here's what you need to weightlift. And has perfect, you know, individual timers for each motion that you're doing. Oh, you're doing 3 minutes of rowing. You do that. Then that timer's done. Okay, now it's time for 30 seconds of jumping jacks. Okay. You know, that kind of stuff is so much more useful on a watch versus on a piece of paper or on your phone. It makes it more simple.
Smart Gym Pro or Smart Gym Manager?
Smart Gym. Hold on. I'll get you.
Tangram Factory. Yeah. I'm installing it right now. Yeah, that looks really
cool. Beautiful. Yeah.
A
beautiful green icon.
There's two Smart Gyms. Yeah, and they both. Oh, you want the green icon. That's the $299 one.
SmartGymApp.com.
SmartGymApp.com. All right.
Yeah.
So we just got the new emojis, and we're already talking about new emojis. Good news, though. Frowning pile of poo has been rejected.
Oh, thank goodness.
Sorry.
We've got to have some standards, damn it.
Giddy poo.
Yeah, we are one step closer towards softball, cupcake, redheads. There's a male and female. Bagel. kangaroo, mango, swan, party face, skateboard, and I don't know why, but spool of thread. Would you use that emoji? That's not
actually just looking at the party face, and I've been to a lot of parties and I've never looked like that. So,
That's a very happy party face.
I can see you using the spool of thread on Twitter.
You know what's really good?
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Oh, spool of thread.
Thread.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Thread. Oh, see, you're better at this than I am. That's good. And now emojis can go left to right or right to left. That's good. Right? Because the gun can fire either way or the train.
Bring back the real gun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the Apple. Apple uses a squirt gun. Everybody else uses a real gun. So that's just the Apple rendering.
But why no roller skate, Leo? There's a rollerblade. There's a skateboard. There's no quad skate.
How are you supposed to cheer for your favorite roller derby person, R2-D2 Nate? There's by the way, Franny Poo, face with okay and face with question marks. Those have been rejected. I'm glad to see.
Thank goodness.
We'll keep you up to date. Thank you, Serenity Caldwell, R2-D2 Nate. You'll find her at imore.com, at Saturn on the Twitter, and follow her roller derby adventures. Is there a place that we can go to follow your roller derby adventures?
Well, most of it happens on Twitter and Instagram, although I do run a separate Twitter account called RD Junkies that does all kinds of videos for and strategy disseminations. But you can just follow the Montreal New Skids on the Block. That's the team I play for currently. And Team Canada Roller Derby.
New Skids on the Block. I love it. Tech Burgers Grill Master is the fabulous Dwight Silverman. We missed you, Dwight, when you were out of tech. I am thrilled you are back.
Read so his- am I.
Yay. Thank we you, missed Leo. You. Tech HoustonChronicle.com/TechBurger at D Silverman on Twitter. Really
We've
nice.
Also got a Twitter account, HC Tech Burger, and we have a Facebook account as well. It's just Tech Burger, so you can find us on both of those platforms.
Nice. Very nice. And, of course, Ian Thompson, who brings just a little more snark to the table. What's smart?
I'm going to call it smark.
That's smart snark. You are Mr. Smark.
Well, snarking with a smile.
Smarking with a smile. TheRegister.co.uk. I-A-I-N Thompson with no P dot.
My parents and I have had words.
Yes. And it is always a pleasure having you up here.
Oh, it's good fun as well.
Trip up. Yeah.
Ian referred to me on Twitter before the show as an interesting chap. And I have to say, he is also an interesting chap.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And have a wonderful time in jolly old... Where do you go? What part of England do you go to?
I'll be spending about a week in London, just catching up with friends and family there, then to back home to Derbyshire and the Peak District.
Nice.
Well, I'll get a white Christmas and then up to
Christmas.
Glasgow for Hogmanay. So I was spending New Year's Eve.
What is the tradition on Hogmanay?
Well, Scotland is unusual in that everyone in the UK gets January the 1st off as a public holiday. Scotland, they get January the 2nd off as a public holiday because the New Year's celebrations are traditionally the time when everyone goes hog wild. They call it Hogmanay. And yeah, I'll be spending...
Will you be dressed in Viking outfits with a flaming torch?
No, I'll be clubbing to the fantastic tunes of Optimo on New Year's Eve and then Jeff Mills on New Year's Day. And that'll finish at about 4 o'clock in the morning both times.
First footing is one of the traditions. After the stroke of midnight, neighbors visit each other bearing traditional symbolic gifts like shortbread or black bun. Mm-hmm. And then you're offered a wee dram of whiskey.
Oh, everyone was offered a wee dram of whiskey.
And of course, let's not forget where the song Auld Lang Syne.
Indeed.
Yes.
Indeed.
A Hogmanay tradition.
Which I found out this week is apparently used in Japan to signify closing time at the end of, in bars.
those
weird cross-cultural things. But
well, I hope you all have a wonderful holiday, and I thank you all for being here. We do twit every Sunday. Right after the radio show, that's 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2300 UTC. If you want to watch live, you can go to youtube.com/live or twit.tv/live. I'm sorry, youtube.com/twit or twit.tv/live. I got that right. And if you're going to do that, watch in the chat room. Participate at irc.twit.tv. We love having in-studio visitors. We have visitors today from Los Angeles visiting. TQ and Chantel, and from Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Nate, thanks for coming by. We do ask if you're going to visit the studios that you let us know ahead of time. We don't like surprises. Email tickets at twit.tv, please. Otherwise, we can't guarantee entry. Tickets at twit.tv. If you can't watch live, sit in studio live, be in the chat room live, you can always do anything you want on demand. Just go to twit.tv. All our shows are there, audio and video. And you should probably subscribe in your favorite podcast app. That way you won't miss an episode. Thanks for being here. We'll be back next week. And then, of course, we have our holiday episodes. And that'll be a lot of fun. But we are doing a live Twit on the 17th, one week from Christmas Eve. That'll be a lot of fun. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit this is in the can. Amazing. Bye-bye. Doing the Twit.